Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Chad Brown here. You may remember me as a linebacker in the NFL or as a reptile breeder and the owner of ProExotic. I've been herping since I was a boy, and I've dedicated my life to advancing the industry and educating the community about the importance of reptiles. I also love to encourage the joy of breeding and keeping reptiles as a hobbyist, which is why my partner Robin Markland and I created the Reptile Report. The Reptile Report is our online news aggregation site bringing you most up-to-date discussions from the reptile world. Visit thereptilereport.com every day to stay on top of the latest reptile news and information. We encourage you to visit the site and submit your exciting reptile news, photos, and links so we can feature outstanding breeders and hobbyists just like you. The Reptile Report offers powerful branding and marketing exposure for your business, and the best part is, it's free. If you're a buyer or a breeder, you gotta check out the Reptile Report Marketplace. The Marketplace is the reptile world's most complete buying and selling destination, full of features to help put you in touch with the perfect deal. Find exactly what you're looking for with our advanced search system. Search by sex, weight, morph, or other keywords, and use our Buy It Now option to buy that animal right now. Go to marketplace.thereptilereport.com and register your account for free. Be sure to link your Marketplace account to your Ship Your Reptiles account to earn free tokens with each shipping label you book. Use the Marketplace to sell your animals and supplies and maximize your exposure with a platinum ad that also gets fed to the Reptile Report and our powerful Marketplace Facebook page. Buying or selling? Use shipyourreptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rate. ShipYourReptiles.com can also supply you with the materials needed to safely ship your animals successfully. Use ShipYourReptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rates, the materials needed to ship the reptiles successfully, live customer support, and our live, on-time arrival insurance program. We got you covered. Visit thereptilereport.com to learn or share about the animals. Click on the link to the marketplace, find that perfect pet or breeder, then visit shipreptiles.com to ship that animal anywhere in the United States. We are your one-stop shop for everything reptile related.
Radio brought to you by Morelia Python's forum, www.moreliapythons.com. I said www again. God damn it.
You did. That's it. Start the whole show over again. Redo it.
What was that
really long pause between the commercial and music?
Hey, I forgot I got to push the button. yeah. So we got a jam-packed episode tonight. We have, first up, we're going to talk to Howard Redding of Reptile Redding.
Me and you
have talked too much today. We're in a long time.
I know.
Redding Reptile.
Over to your place before the show.
Yeah, Redding Reptile Breeders. We're going to be talking about the Northwest Carpet Fest real quick. Then after that, we're going to have Robin Markland come on and from the Reptile Report, and we're going to be talking about a subject that is near and dear to me on the Reptile Insider. It is about Facebook versus forum, and I can say that tonight I was looking for, because we're I was looking for a picture of a ring python. It was a new morph that popped up. And I could not find it anywhere on Facebook. It drove me absolutely bonkers. I couldn't find it. I tried to remember the breeder's name. I couldn't remember the breeder's name. But so there you go. And then after that, we're joined by Chris from Mystic Reptiles. And he's going to be coming on, and we're going to be talking about ring pythons. We're going to be talking about carpet pythons. We're going to be talking about retics. We're going to be talking about tips and stuff for, running a reptile business. We're talking about the upcoming legislation. You name it, we got it. So real quick, let's get it going. Let's bring Howard on real quick. Hey, Howard, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys, what's going on?
Northwest
hey,
Carpet
nothing
this
much.
Weekend.
Right on, right on. Hey, I don't want to hold you all up. I know you got a packed show this evening. Real quick, I got to soak up the Northwest Carpet Fest. It's their second annual, and they're going to, well, they think they're going to do better than the Northeast does, but I hope they do. Anyway, they don't have any salmon-flavored vodka, so gooey on that.
Oh, sold out? Yeah, that's lacking.
Yeah. Anyway, please go to the Northwest Carpet page, Carpet Fest page. There's a lot of gift certificates and vouchers from some of the top carpet python breeders in the country, and me too. So you can definitely make a deal there. I really don't want to take up time to mention all the names, but you know who they are. Mm-hmm. Also, if for any contact information to be able to post on to be able to bid on this stuff, the contact is Heather Oshimbo at mysticexotics@gmail.com, and she's the one that's been making all this happen. Their host is Doug Taylor, another incredible python breeder. What else? Yeah, go out there and bid. Get that auction going. You have all the proceeds go to RICO. It's split 50-50 unless otherwise noted between RICO and USARC. Do it up, guys. Just go into it. It's for a great cause. You know, once again, that's mysticexotics@gmail.com. And with any information or questions, Heather will definitely be able to take care of you with that. So without further ado, enjoy your evening, and I look forward to listening to both Robin and Chris.
Cool.
Awesome.
Thanks, Howard.
Thank you, Howard.
Love you much. See ya.
See ya.
Bye.
That was Howard, our infield reporter with Richie. Thank you, Howard. So
We also
I hope you do well.
Yeah, it's this Saturday. If any of you are out on the West Coast, and you want to go hang out with some cool carpet python people, I think there's probably other people going too. I'm not really sure. I wish we were going, but unfortunately we're not. And the link is you go to their Facebook page and you'll see all the auction items. I put a link up on our Facebook page, but if not, just type in NW Carpet Fest and it'll come up. And go over there and check it out. There's some really cool, a lot of vouchers and stuff, so a lot of cool things happening as far as hatching out in the carpet python world, and some of the breeders do other stuff as well. So you can, if you're looking to purchase a new snake, you'll be supporting a good cause and getting a cool snake. So go check it out.
And if you are going, and if you could make Nick Mutton eat like a squirrel or something to up the rat from last year, I would greatly appreciate it because I think it's just great. So I'm pretty sure we just keep going year after year, get Nick to eat weird things. So
exactly. We have Robin coming on the show, and again, like I said, you know, I've been banging this bell for a long time. I'm curious to see what Robin has to say about it, but I believe that forums are better because it archives the material better. So when you have new people coming into the world, of reptiles, which, you know, hopefully that continues to happen and the reptile community continues to grow. They can go back and, I don't know, it just makes some of those easier questions, beginner questions kind of right there. People can research it.
You can look through a database and find the answers to some of the questions that sometimes people are afraid to ask because they don't want to sound stupid or new. They're all right there. And also, sometimes they don't really get received very well for asking the same question over and over and over again. But, you know,
yeah,
it is what it is.
Yeah.
Also, I know you were diving around looking for pictures and posts on Facebook, and they're driving you up a wall. So
yeah. It makes it so hard, but So let's get Robin on here. Hey, Robin, welcome to Morelli Python Radio. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me, fellas. I'm happy to be here.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So
what's your take on
that? What's your take? You want to do Facebook or do you believe in the forums? Which one would you kind of side with more?
Well, I mean, from hearing your discussion and short intro there, it sounds like it's going to be a fairly one-sided discussion. I'm a big fan of the forums as well.
Okay.
I kind of lament their downturn of late. You know, I mean, social media has had a huge impact on the hobby and the industry and the community. And some parts are positive, but, you know, other parts are definitely negative. And I worry a lot about the short-term effects versus the long-term effects, you know, that we're going to see on the hobby itself and the community. Because, you know, Facebook is a super powerful tool. And the other, you know, Twitter and Instagram and these other platforms are really powerful. But over the long term, as you guys already hit on, this isn't helping. They don't help to cultivate new keepers. It's a lot of one-shot pictures and short comments, and we're missing, if you're not on the forums, you're missing a lot of the more in-depth discussion and being able to have a decent back-and-forth discussion with an expert or a breeder or somebody that works with your species or somebody that, you know, has worked with your species for maybe 20 years. And the short attention span of Facebook or Instagram or Twitter just doesn't lend itself to that. And I know it's, you know, social media is all the rage with the kids, but boy, I do miss the depth and power of the forums. They're still there, but they've definitely taken a hit from social media, and I'm anxious to see if that's going to continue or if we can see maybe a turn back to that, because, you know, everything is the flavor of the moment. So, and I'm happy to discuss as much as you want. I see Facebook definitely waning at this point. So, you know, maybe that this is going to be now a turn to come back the other way. I would certainly welcome that. I think it would be a great thing for the community and the industry as a whole.
Do you think it dumbs down the herper? Do you think that tends to dumb down people?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. If I can post just a single picture and you know, most of the comments are that's really nice looking or, you know, congrats on the eggs, and that's the depth of the discussion, then you're not learning anything and I'm not learning anything.
Right.
If True. You can have a discussion on a forum and you post up a clutch of eggs or a recent breeding or, better yet, an attempted breeding, hey, I've got, you know, they've locked up five times but I'm not getting eggs or I'm not getting ovulation. What do you think is going on? That type of discussion doesn't happen in the short attention span world of social media, on Facebook and Twitter and such. And so, yeah, it prevents that type of in-depth, kind of more detailed discussion. And so it absolutely, I think, dumbs it down.
Yeah, I think, like, one of the things that I miss is, like, I'll speak about Morelia Python's forum, for example. So you have some species of Morelia that are still – there's one that hasn't been bred, Halmahera scrub pythons, and Bolins are still one of those ones that are not, bred all the time in captivity. So what you would see is that if you had a post there, somebody would say, okay, it was locking up and it was the start of their season, but you could see it progress through, you know, to all the way if they had eggs and if they hatched. So it was kind of like you could watch what they were doing. They could post some information. I don't see that same type of timeline on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, social media. And it just kind of makes it, you know, I don't know. It's not the same follow, I guess. I don't know. Maybe – I don't know if you guys agree or not, but I kind of like how you can see a timeline, you know?
Yeah, like I said, I don't know. I don't know how interesting it's going to be because we all basically agree on the same thing. So
I disagree entirely. Then it's Facebook's amazing. So
that's the worst thing you've ever said. The Bolins is a great example. In fact, it's a perfect example. And Frederick in Europe, I can't remember offhand exactly where he's at. He's had two clutches this year.
Yep. Yeah.
And of a few eggs. And we can have a discussion about what is a successful clutch. You know, to me, a Bolins probably lays 25-plus eggs. So getting 6 or 7 is a nice step, but it's not complete success. There's still lots of improvement there. But Frederick has posted pictures of eggs, and last year he posted pictures of babies. But where did he post them? You can't search Facebook and find that stuff.
Right.
You can't pull up his old stuff. You can't, you know, he's commented on this page, and he's commented on this Facebook page, and he's commented, somebody congratulated him over here, so he made some comments here. You can't, I mean, it's only been a few weeks since he made his posts about this year's clutches. You can't find that stuff right now. So how is anybody to learn from that? And, you know, I sent him some private messages. I said, hey, you know, we'd love to cover it at the Reptile Report. You know, we worked with Bolins for 15 years, and what a fascinating species, and how amazingly frustrating because we weren't able to breed them. You know, there's a challenge and a puzzle with that species. And by the way, that's my single favorite species of snakes. I love the Bolins python. So I want to know more about it, Fred. Can you, can you tell me some details? What did you do to get this far? It's farther than I got. What can you tell me about it? And he said, you know, I posted a little bit here, I posted a little bit there. That doesn't do me any good because, you know, if it's more than days ago, I'm never going to find it. Whereas if this happened all on a forum in a particular thread, we could all follow along and reference it and have a deeper discussion about it. I could go on and chime in and say, here's what my experience was is over 15-plus years of trying to work with the animals, blah, 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 blah. Here's my pictures. And we talked about my ultrasound experiences. You know, other keepers could come on. Ari could chime in about, you know, his Bolins knowledge. Mark Spataro could say something about his Bolins knowledge. And it could be we could have that traditional community discussion where everybody can benefit from it. Even if you're not contributing, at least you can read and learn from it and say, how can I apply this stuff and these experiences to not just Bolins, but, you know, my other python species or my other Morelia species. But, it's frustrating right now because, you know, sometimes I'll be out of town or I'll be on the road and I don't hear about something that Frederick's posted. And Ari will say, oh, you know, Frederick posted up such and such things. Shit, it's too late now. I can't find it. And that frustrates me. And I think that really speaks. Like, that's a perfect example because it speaks to the limitation of those social media platforms. And to me, it says, boy, we really need to make sure that we're including all of this content on the forums because that's where it belongs so that we can all learn and grow from it.
Right.
So, okay, so, so since we're all kind of in agreement with that, and you know, what do you think, how do you think that you would get people to go back to the forum? Like, what would drive them back there? You know, I kind of think that if you got, like, again, I'll use Morelia as an example. I see some of the top Morelia breeders, and they don't post on that forum. But if they – they don't post on the forum. They post on Facebook. And I kind of understand why, but at the same time, probably because it's just so easy to do. But I don't understand. I guess if they would go and post there, like, you know, so a new carpet python morph hatched out or somebody hatched Halmahera scrubs, that's going to drive everybody to that forum to see – to see it, but they've already seen it on Facebook, so they're not going to go. So you got any ideas on how you get people to go back to the forum?
It's very tough, and I've really been thinking about it a lot lately. You know, in my own experience for the Reptile Report, Ship Your Reptiles page, my effectiveness and reach continues to decline on Facebook in particular. And so I'm, you know, for me, I'm trying to think of where else can I reach my audience. And
right.
the forums have, you know, always been strong. But I'm wondering, are, you know, is everybody else having the same experience? And from the folks I talk to on the business side, you know, the breeders and the company side, you know, the business pages, they're all seeing that similar type of effect. So Facebook has been awesome for reaching a large number of people, no question. It's just that the engagement is different. They're, like I said, you're just sharing snippets of information, you know, pictures, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you're not getting the discussion side of things so much. But
the thing
that really solidified Facebook was the ability to quickly sell stuff. You know, if you have your 2,000 friends or your 10,000 likes or whatever, you post up, I have this snake available for sale, $100, you're able to sell it quickly and easily. You know, it went pretty quick. And that has a obviously has a ton of appeal for the business side. And that really helps solidify Facebook as the place to be because you were able to sell stuff quickly and easily. But at this point, with that diminishing exposure, the sales are starting to become significantly affected. So the Reptile Report page, for example, has 80,000 likes at this point. So it's a good-sized page. But any
right.
typical post we make, unless it has some other draw or some other superstar aspect to it, a typical post only reaches perhaps 2% of that audience. So only a small percent of the audience sees any one particular post. It used to be 30%. And then I thought, well, that kind of sucks, 30%. You know, geez, I'd like
right.
to have 100%. And
yeah, right.
that's 100%. I mean, now, you know, I'd kick a small child to get 30% back.
right.
Have 2% is very, very difficult now to reach my audience. And we have to be very careful and strategic and work very hard to make sure that we have enough posts out to reach the audience, they're interesting enough, we're getting it, you know, to maximize our engagement. So as that engagement and reach keeps diminishing, and it's all based on because Facebook wants you to pay now to reach your audience, then that means that the sales on Facebook are going to be less effective. People are going to post up their $100 animal, their snake or gecko or whatever it is, and so many fewer people are going to see it that it's now it's not going to sell. And you see
right.
that some people are trying auctions and things like that. And, you know, Ben
mm-hmm.
does bonkers business with auctions. But the average keeper can't do auctions well because it's just not reaching a critical mass of people. So as the sales side diminishes on Facebook, as the effectiveness diminishes, and it's coming quickly, then that lowers the value of that platform overall. And so I
right.
think that is going to be key in driving people to look somewhere else because they're still interested in the animals, whether it be Morelia, whether it be amphibians, you know, whether geckos or whatever their interest is, they still want to consume the content. So if they're not able to get a great benefit off of the Facebook page, then it has to happen somewhere else. And I'm hoping that people turn to forums to fulfill that informational and resource need. I think it's the best single source of the information itself. But I don't think there's anything we can do to necessarily make that happen quicker.
Right.
We just be able to read and react as it's happening, you know, and make sure that the forums are as interesting and viable and vibrant as they can possibly be. You know, your suggestion of, you know, getting key breeders to participate more is definitely key. I mean, if we have the content there, people will definitely come and view it, especially as the effectiveness of these other platforms diminishes.
Have you seen an increase in, because we're talking the Reptile Report, now you guys pretty much scour the web looking for the,
yep.
The greatest, you know, stories or pictures or discussions,
yes.
yeah, and you kind of put it up there. Have you seen? Are you able to track like an increase of forum traffic? Because, you know,
yeah,
I mean, like, if you go to Morelia
uh-huh.
Reptile Report, it kind of, you got Morelia to Virtus Forum, you got the Morelia Forums, you know. Do you see people doing that?
I mean, off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you the numbers for a specific species. You know, is the gecko section up or down, or is Morelia up or down? But I can tell you this, and I'm not going to give you fantastic news, but I'll be square with you and tell you what we see. We compare every week. We do an end-of-week report, and we compare
uh-huh.
it to last year this week.
Okay.
And right now, you know, we go out, and, yeah, we every day we have a staff of three editors that goes to all of the forums and pulls the most interesting topics and discussion, and we, you know, we link it from the Reptile Report back to the forum. So we say, you know, if you're interested in geckos, well, here's all the interesting gecko conversation from the day. Go to geckoforums.net or go to, you know, Bush League or Morelia Forum, wherever it's going to be, go there and check it out. And last year, this year's numbers compared to last year, the number of threads and referrals is down 30%.
Huh.
So there's less
wow.
overall that we're seeing happening on forums. Now,
wow.
the Facebook part of the content is up significantly.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, you know, but the Facebook content, the forum content is strong. If you look at the Reptile Report and you look at all the different forum links, discussion about breeding this, it's hatchings of this, it's new species of this and that and the other, all really interesting stuff. If you look at any of the Facebook content, it's here's one picture. Those look at the one picture. Here's one
right.
picture. One picture. Here's one picture. Look at the one picture. There's a lot of that because there's a lot of interesting single pictures. But now
right.
I'm starting to get feedback from the audience that says, you know, I'm not really into just a bunch of posts about single friggin' pictures.
Right.
I want some deeper discussion, which gives me hope that, now you're starting to kind of tire of that one-shot, one-picture Facebook-style thing. Because it's
right.
not that fulfilling. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you
sure.
know, I love a bunch of really pretty snakes. One at a time is a little tedious, but still, I mean, it's a gorgeous animal. It's a gorgeous animal. But it's not that fulfilling to me as somebody interested in reptiles, especially on the breeding side. Like, you know, we spent 20 years breeding animals. I'm fascinated with the husbandry. I'm fascinated with the logistics. I'm fascinated with the process of making them breed. I want to know why boneless pythons don't breed in captivity. That is
right.
interesting and fascinating to me. And at the same time, I love seeing a first-time keeper breed Pictus geckos and be excited about it. I mean, that's friggin' awesome. So that's what
right.
I'm interested in. The one-shot picture deal, you know, it's, there's another great picture of a ball python. Right on. It's not that satisfying for from the herpetocultural side, you know. It's not that fulfilling. So that's what, I'm starting to see that feedback. We do have less forum content and more single-shot Facebook content. But number one, my editors give me feedback and they say, geez, I really don't want to post all these, you know, single pictures. I don't think it's good. And then
right.
readers comment and say, you know, hey, we're, you know, kind of a lot of single Facebook pictures. So, you know, it kind of comes and goes and you know, it wanes. And I'm hoping now that there's going to be a shift, you know, kind of overloaded on the single Facebook picture thing. So now people will start to become more interested in the discussion and the actual meaty type content. And once they get to the forum, then they'll start participating and commenting, and I think that experience is very fulfilling.
Yeah, it's kind of like this vicious circle. So, like, if a forum all of a sudden doesn't have the content, nobody's going to go there, and then nobody's going there because there's no content. But then when you can't participate if there's no content. So it's like, you know, you got to get the content flowing, and I think then people would head over and they would see. Maybe it's a whole bunch of new people coming into the hobby. And I mean, I think, would you guys agree that you kind of grow as a keeper, you know, you start out and you're like looking at, you know, oh, this is a cool looking snake. You know, I really dig this. And and then all of a sudden you're trying to figure out what makes it tick, you know. I mean, at least that's how I progressed. It's kind of like, and then you might go into a more advanced species and now you're really trying to figure out natural history, you know, who's had success with this species, who hasn't, what have they done, what are their approaches.
Right.
You know, currently I'm looking outside of the species and trying to look at what other people have done, whether it's with a species from the same, you know, same environment, you know, maybe to think outside the box. And I think that forums really lend itself to that. So I don't know.
They do.
Hopefully
they do cultivate that type of keeper, and that is nothing but good for the hobby. If we go, if nothing changes and we go over another 10 years of people looking at single photos, well, shit, nobody's going to breed anything. But you can't learn how to breed. You can't
right.
get feedback by looking at photos of snakes. That doesn't help you. It, you know, hey, I want to get there one day. You got to figure out how to get there one day. And you're going to do that with discussion and communication and sharing and learning from each other, from other breeders, from other hobbyists. That's how you're going to do that. And, you know, the forums are crucial, you know.
Right.
Although, as a whole, overall, when I look at society from a wider lens, sometimes I worry that the movie Idiocracy is going to come true and we're all going to end up in, living in
God,
the dumb-dumb
world.
So, man, sometimes I have to wonder, you know. Sometimes it blows my mind. I don't want to be there, you know. I want to have some kind of intelligent discussion, but,
right.
You know, yeah, it means that the single picture thing is going to have to run its course. But, you know, I work hard to try and have an idea of what's happening next, and I do see indications that that is playing out. You know, that's starting to play itself out.
Wow.
And I think
that's
a
good
thing
to hear.
I'm not going to do anything to keep it up.
Yeah, I think one of the I don't know if people have caught on to this yet, but I'm going to throw this out there. There's an app you can get on your phone. It's called Tap Talk. And pretty much if you look at that app, you can go in whatever forums have that feature available. You can, you know, put it on your phone, and pretty much it kind of goes like a Facebook type of feel to it, but it's the forum on your phone. You can upload pictures just as simple, you know, and it's a pretty cool app. I know that Morelia Pythons is working on getting it, but even with that, if you just go to the actual website itself, I think he made that forum, Sean made that forum, you know, I think you can somehow make your website be, you know, like a phone friendly, I guess, and it you can follow it pretty easy. Well, I hope that that happens a lot sooner than later, because I missed the forum.
We don't want to overstate it. There's still plenty of great discussion happening there.
Yeah.
I think it's just important that we don't lose focus of the great discussions that's there, and you know, let folks know and remind folks that make that a part of your daily, you know, browsing habits. Go to the forums and check them out. You know, go to the forums and participate. I mean, that's, you know, that's where the future of the hobby is from people learning and sharing with each other. And I think that's important. So people have to participate so that we can, you know, continue to have a real vibrant, strong hobby.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and I think you guys do a great job as far as making our lives easier. As far with the Reptile Report, I mean, you pretty much serve us the best of the best on a platter every day. You just kind of should hit there first, and then, you know, head out to where you want to go. And
absolutely,
awesome job you guys are doing. So
thanks, I appreciate it. Maybe
Absolutely.
Next time we'll come up with a topic where we can fight a little bit or something.
Yeah, we'll yeah.
Yeah,
we'll find something we all disagree on.
Maybe next week we can do a topic, what's your favorite soup?
we can
debate about that.
Many wars have been fought over such.
I probably should have let you know ahead of time how I felt about the Facebook forum thing, but I've been banging that gong forever, and everybody kind of tells me, there's a lot of younger people that tell me, no, Facebook is the cool, hip place. And it is, I mean, it is a good, you know, a good tool, like you said, for reaching people and stuff. But at the same time,
that's diminishing. So, you know, again, the effectiveness is dropping off. And a lot of that has to do with Facebook going public. You know, they got to have all these revenues to, you know, serve their shareholders. So, you know, just to give you an idea, we do post a lot of content and links at the Reptile Report Facebook page. And in order for us to reach the audience, you know, Facebook suggests, hey, you should boost a post or place an ad or whatever. Facebook literally wants me to spend $30,000 a month to advertise and push to reach my audience.
Wow.
And what a freaking disconnect. I mean, I'm a small business, you know.
Yeah.
$1,000 a month, I could work that into my advertising budget. But you're acting like the small businesses are Taco Bell or something. I can't spend $500,000 a year trying to reach an audience. I mean, I think they're just completely missing the mark, and I think that's going to be, you know, the death knell for their effectiveness. And so they want to keep driving it, you know, the organic reach down so that we have to pay. But, Jack, you're going to be waiting forever if you want to get $30,000 a month out of me. I mean, it's just, that's impossible.
Heck yeah. Wow. Wow, that's crazy. Oh, well.
Yeah, the world is crazy.
Yeah, that's true. All right, so, I guess check out the reptilereport.com. We got shipyourreptiles.com and, what is it, marketplace.thereptilereport.com?
Yep, the new marketplace, our new classified system. You can link to it from any of the Reptile Report pages. There's a quick link to Marketplace. Awesome. But, yeah, check all those out and appreciate the support, fellas.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely.
All right. Until next week, I guess.
Until next week. Have a good show.
You too.
All right, thanks, Rob.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's right. We probably should have had a topic that we could argue about. Or we need Zach.
Yeah, Yeah.
Yeah, we need Zach.
We should do better.
Okay. So. But there you go. We have Chris on the line here. So we're gonna click him on. Let's see. Hopefully that's him. Chris, is that you?
Hey guys.
Hey,
how
what's
you doing,
up?
Greg? Good. What's our view tonight? All right.
Okay.
All right.
Sweet.
Yeah. Hey, if you guys, if my reception goes in or out, just let me know. Okay.
You got it.
So.
Okay.
How you guys
so.
Been?
Yeah, we're doing good. How about you?
I'm pretty good.
Good. So we wanted to have you back on because we wanted to have a little more in-depth conversation about some of the species that you work with and some different thoughts of, running a reptile business and efficiency and all that kind of stuff. But one of the species that kind of have me and Owen both excited at the moment is ring pythons, and I know that you work with them and you've successfully bred them a few years, so I thought maybe we'd go, I don't know how in depth we can go, but I thought maybe we would talk a little bit about what's going on with your rings and et cetera. So I don't think we really got into that in the we kind of skimmed the surface, but
right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious to talk about that species. Me and Owen are in a race, just so you know, to see who can
get
the
massive race
there first. And I don't know. We're just excited about it. Owen had a pair, and actually, I don't know what happened.
Like an idiot, he sold them. Yeah, like a moron.
Dummy.
So,
How long ago was that?
2 years ago, maybe.
Really?
I think so.
Kidding
maybe sooner.
That, huh?
Yeah, yeah, I do. So,
I don't know if it's just me or if there's maybe people are listening to the show and hear us talk about it. They're excited about it. Maybe people have had them secretly for a few years and now they're starting to breed them. But it seems like I'm seeing them more often than I ever have in the past. So,
where at? Advertised or shows?
No. Just people breeding them and keeping them, and I guess it's just on my Facebook feed. And Somehow they get posted on Morelia Pick of the Week.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of people in the shadows, it seems like, that keep them, that like those kind of niche species. I think there's a lot more people out there that have them than we think. But there's certainly demand, but the supply is just not there to meet it, you know.
Why? You think that you'll see a resurgence in the people wanting to get into them? Have you seen that? Like, do you think that will drive people to try to breed them more?
I hope so. I think it's good for, you know, the species. It's good for everybody if, you know, these animals, if we have success with it, you know, in captivity. You know, it's like I talked about, they were something that, you know, were available years ago for cheap, but they just, like a lot of things, they kind of cycle, and they kind of went away. They, you know, people started going in different directions in ball python market, and you know, before you know it, there's not a whole lot of people working with them because there's no morphs. So, you know, they are not the easiest species to keep. I would say they're, to me, you know, I was trying to think of a good way to describe ring pythons, and in working with them, I think the best description is that they're more like a colubrid than they are a python.
Yeah.
They really are, if you look at them, they're more like a king snake. Their head structure, their body, the way they feed, it's really remarkable. If you didn't know any different, you would think, this is a king snake, you know?
Wow.
And just the way they transform as a baby, it's so interesting because as neonates, they're so fragile and delicate, literally in every sense, in every way. And then as they, you know, after they get that past that year mark, they just transform into a feeding monster. And, you know, their body changes into almost like a different kind of snake because they have this strength and they're just durable and they're, you know, just a different snake. They're tough. But, you know, it's just, I don't really see that with another species. So it's kind of neat.
So what are you working with? Are you working with a couple pairs? Like, if you wanted to get into the species, what would you recommend as far as, you know, how to have success? Because I think one of the things that I heard was that they can be mate selective, and I don't know if it's a false or not, but the whole thing where the female kills the male, is that any of your experience, or?
Yeah, I mean, my first suggestion would be to get as many as you can afford.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's the simple, you know, answer to that. But I would definitely have multiple males. You know, if you get a pair, you know, you're rolling the dice because I do have some males that just won't breed with certain females. I mean, the group that I have is, it's not a huge group. It's, I have 2.4 right now. So it's not a huge group, but they're a little older. And, you know, as far as the compatibility, it's kind of weird because I just went ahead and threw the whole group into a 6-foot cage and put a high box on each end and just, you know, see what happens. And I didn't know if they were going to kill each other or breed like crazy or what, but there is sort of an initial aggression they have towards each other. They didn't kill each other, but I do know, I've heard cases where that happens and actually where they, you know, eat each other. But I haven't experienced that with mine. Initially, when I introduce a male, they have constricted each other, so you have to be careful. But once you get past that initial, I think that's kind of common with some python species, but once you break them up, for lack of a better word, they're pretty good. They're no problem, but you just have to keep an eye on them for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not one of those type of species where you can just kind of like leave it in the cage and walk away and come back later. And
not initially. I wouldn't do that, you know, at least not for the first half hour or so. I mean, after that, they're usually, if there's going to be any aggression, it's usually the first initial introduction in my experience.
Okay. Cool. What about as far as getting the, the babies going? You were saying that they kind of have a little bit of time where they're kind of very delicate and then they're bulletproof. What are you doing to get the babies going?
Yeah, in my experience, it's kind of cut and dry. The babies, if they're going to feed, if they're going to live, they usually start off right off the bat eating. The ones that, don't eat in the first two attempts, in my experience, they're probably not going to make it, to be honest, because I've done everything. I've done the, tube feeding, and I've even attempted to force feed, which is extremely difficult with them, with their heads, but because they're so small and fragile.
Mm-hmm.
But you're only, delaying the inevitable because, there's a certain percentage out of a clutch that's just not going to make it. For whatever reason, I have some that I have picked out right from the start. This is a holdback, absolutely beautiful, high contrast pattern, just stick out, and they didn't make it despite everything that I could think of to try to keep them alive. So,
right,
that's the thing with rings is you just sometimes nature's going to take its course and it's kind of out of your hands. So. I absolutely do everything I can to keep them going, but it's just rings can be difficult, some of them, to get going. But the ones that do feed are usually good to go. I mean, they have a great feed response, and they're really not difficult. So it's like a lot of the white Asis or, that kind of white lips and water pythons, things like that.
Yeah.
You get the head of the pink in their mouth, and usually the rest of it takes over, so.
Yeah, instinct kicks in. What are your thoughts, though? I mean, do you think that ultimately that's better for the species, for these non-feeders, not to, I know this kind of sounds harsh, but not to make it? Because to me, it's like if you have, snakes that are feeding right out of the egg, some people would say the other ones shouldn't be kept or try to be saved or, to try to strengthen
mm-hmm.
the species.
Gene pool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's, as keepers, as breeders, we try to save everything, especially if you're looking at it as far as financial gain, you want to have the most return
sure.
on your investment. So you can definitely look at it in terms of that. Dollar signs, well, okay, I just lost three. So how many, what does that add up to? You could blow your brains out.
Yes,
start
yeah.
thinking in that term of, in those terms as far as like, oh, geez, all this money's down the drain. So you definitely don't want to do that because you just beat yourself up. But it's nature's going to take its course. There's some things that it's just, snakes are crazy. It's, despite everything you do, it's like, okay, if you don't realize this, but you're going to die if you don't eat,
Yeah.
The water's right there. You don't have to be dehydrated. Just drink. But sometimes some need a little more help to get going. And there's tricks and little things that you can do to help them along, but some of them are just not meant to be, and it kind of sucks, but you know, maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. We can only, you know, play God so much, in, you know, in our snake rooms.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. Do they fall into that same type of, you know, with, I think of white lips and, you know, if they dry out, then they could die. Do they fall into that same type of thing where they're not having fresh water all the time or?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what I mean about being fragile. That's another aspect of being fragile as babies, you know. Papua New Guinea species, they're tropical rainforests, and they are definitely prone to dehydration. So I actually keep mine in the incubator for as long as possible as babies. That way I can just make sure that the humidity and temperature is controlled. I do that for, you know, sometimes 3 months.
Really?
If possible. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That's, I mean, cool. I don't maintain it at 90 degrees or anything. I mean, I lower it, but that
right.
way it's, you know, instead of relying on moss containers or something like that, you know, hey, I'm going to take variables out and just keep them in the incubator. So I found that to be pretty effective, just to stabilize them and keep them going, because they, you know, they have very thin skin, and they can, if they don't have clean water, fresh water, if they're not getting nutrition, yeah, you're going to see them go downhill real quick. I mean, some babies I will, you know, you can wait about a month, okay, they don't feed. So then you start taking things into your own hands. Even after I force-fed them or, you know, tubed them, they will still, they'll reach that point of no return. So they're still going to go no matter what at that point. So it seems like with rings, you have a time limit, and the clock is ticking, you know. So
right.
I'm saying that it's just you want to be aware of it, you know.
Sure, sure, absolutely. So when you're keeping them in the incubator, what are you putting the temperature at? What's the temperature set?
It's, I believe, you know, if I temp gun them, it's probably around 84, 85.
Okay. All right. Cool. Very cool. So there's the other thing is I was curious to know your thoughts on, and I looked for it. Like I said earlier in the show, I looked for it all day to try to find the picture to post it up, and I didn't know if you saw it or didn't see it, but they had a new morph, well, what they're saying is a morph, pop out from ring pythons. So did you see it, and what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I did come across that, and doesn't it look like kind of a Savu a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought when I initially saw it. I was like, wow, it looks incredible. You know, it's like there's no rings to it. It's just, it's kind of a light orange, and it's got these kind of freckles all over it. That's incredible. I mean, think about what that would do for that species in the hobby, you know, to have something different out there. I wasn't able to read the whole, article on it though, when I clicked over there. So
yeah.
I didn't get any story behind it. I just kind of saw the picture, and that's all I could find on it, but. Very
right.
cool, yeah.
Do you see a lot of variability in the babies when they hatch, or is it pretty much, I mean, are some striped, some not, some banded, some more, some?
That's kind of the cool thing about them is that there's a lot of variability, believe it or not. I'll have some that are totally ringed. I'll have some that are just devoid of any pattern at all. And then you'll have some that are, I had one hatch out that had kind of tiger stripes. It was the most incredible ring I've ever had.
Wow.
And it made it for, I don't know, 8 months, and then it just died for no reason.
Damn.
That was a bummer. It looked really cool. I have some pictures of it. It was just really neat. It literally looked like a tiger. And I heard you guys talk in another show. I don't remember who it was, but they're like, it's always the cool one. It's always the ones you don't want to go.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Uh-huh.
You know? But, there's some that have longitudinal striping also. So, a lot of the buyers, it's all kind of a preference thing. I mean, some like the aberrant pattern, some like the real classic ring look. Personally, I kind of like the more classic ring look because I think it has more contrast to it,
right.
Even as adults. But, there's a lot of variability with them.
I bet you it's one of those. I mean, I know that I guess if you could somehow make an adult look like a baby, I think they would be probably one of the coolest snakes ever. But
yeah.
I would bet, I'm almost betting, because I didn't get water pythons, I didn't get olive pythons, I didn't get white lips really, like, until I saw them in person. And then, that iridescent sheen that you see, and, is that similar to what's going on with them as adults? I mean, I know they don't have that same contrast, but I bet you they're just one of those snakes, when you see them as adults, you're probably like, man, that's a badass snake.
Yeah. I mean, you really do. You have to take them outside in the sun to appreciate them. It's, I don't know, one of the most iridescent species I could think of. I think there's like a sunbeam snake or something like that that's
right.
Ridiculous. It looks like, oil on water. But, yeah, they're very, very impressive. Outside in the sun, with that sun hitting them, and they just glow, literally. So as adults, they're not bright, and that's the thing. The most common comment that I get: well, if they stay orange and black like that, but they're like that for a reason. I think the adults are magnificent in a different way. So it's just something you have to appreciate by keeping them and seeing them. But,
it's like Owen will tell you, I went over to his place and it was like olive pythons. So he's had these olive pythons for a while. And, it's just a brown snake. And it was kind of like, it's cool, I guess. It's an olive python, whatever. But then when I saw the...
Bloody freaking duh, dude. Yeah, I know.
I'm all about, I like contrast. I'm a contrast guy. I like stripes, that kind of thing. So, when I saw it, but, man, I'll tell you what, when I had it in my hands, that's it. It's all done, man. I was like, wow, this is a cool species, And I would imagine they're the same, so.
Yeah, definitely. Very similar.
Cool. Awesome.
They are cool. So the moral is everybody should buy rings and other types of animals that Owen wants. So anyways, can you tell us what's going on with your retic project? I know that there are a bunch of people talking about retics nowadays. So what do you guys got going on there?
I've really kind of closed my colony down. I haven't introduced any new animals for probably a year, there's a few reasons behind that, but the morphs I have, I'm just kind of, I'm pretty excited about the projects. They're, I'm not anything top of the line by any means, but do you want to hear about the morphs or, just...
So tell us in general what you got going on retic-wise. You guys are actively breeding, right?
Yeah, it was a good year. I had about halfway towards my goal of having 10 females, 10 clutches. Remember, these clutches are, you're looking at 40 to, 60 eggs, so... That's a lot of babies.
Wow.
A lot of babies.
Wow.
That's a lot of babies.
Yeah, man. As far as ball python breeders are what? 5 or 6 clutches? That's, that's 256. But, it was a pretty good year. some things I hit on that I didn't expect to. Genetic stripes, that was a pleasant surprise.
Always.
Yeah, man, there's something that's been in the hobby for a while. And, you know, it was a long project, and I had a big female. They're actually a dwarf, but my original female that I got as a sub-adult ended up turning into a 15-foot monster. I think she might have literally been the largest genetic stripe, you know, in the hobby. I can't verify that, but she was big. And she ended up just passing slugs through her life. So luckily, you know, I finally got a clutch of them, and they're just amazing. They're just beautiful, beautiful snakes. So when you combine the other genes on top of that, you know, the Sunfire, the Platinum, just different stuff. You just really, that's the thing that's cool about retics is that, you know, there's just so much you can do with them. But I had, interesting story, I had a purple female that I was looking forward to possibly getting some albino golden childs from. So I had two males that, purple golden child males that I put in with her. They were young, they were on the younger side, but I thought that they would be, you know, able to get the job done. So I had these two males rotating with this female for, I don't know, about a month. So I took them out and then put this albino super tiger male in just for like a day or two because I was just, I didn't have anywhere else to put him. And sure enough, he's the one that got the job done. So,
yeah, I'm not. Doesn't that figure?
So I didn't get necessarily what I wanted to. It was a disappointment as far as that goes. But, you know, it's always good to produce and have, you know, purple tigers and that kind of thing. But it's just funny how you could try so hard with one thing and then another stud just goes in there and blows it out of the water. So sometimes
yeah.
That happens.
Sometimes the boy just, because I just had the same thing happen with clutch of tigers. So sometimes it's that one who gets it.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, so definitely a good year. And it's productive year, so hopefully I won't go out of business anytime soon. And there's some good things around the corner. This coming season should be very good for retics. All my females will be up to size, so I should be expecting a lot of ivories. Let's see what else. Orange ghost stripes, which are really hot right now. They're new enough to where there's stuff being done with them, but they're not saturated in the market. And the price is still high on that kind of thing. So there's Island Dwarf Solaire retic that I mentioned last time that I'm really excited about. Just a really cool species. I mean, I love normal retics, you know. I don't you know, necessarily need the morphs, but just looking at a normal retic is just incredible on its own. So, you know, a lot of good things happening, I think.
Cool. So now, how do you feel about people crossing morphs to the dwarf retics?
In what way? As far as the size goes?
Yeah, I mean, doesn't it kind of take away from the, I know that we're trying to keep super dwarf retics staying smaller size, but, you know, when you cross morphs into it, doesn't that kind of defeat the purpose?
Well, that's kind of where it seems like that market is going, towards the smaller animals, because there's not as many people that can house, you know, a mainland size retic. So people want the beauty, they want the animal, but something in a small package. So you start breeding with dwarfs, super dwarfs, and breeding that into a mainland line, and you're, you know, over generations, that percentage gets you into a smaller package. So That's something I'm doing? No, not necessarily. But I see it being done. And
okay.
Can it be done with consistent results?
Yeah, can you get a retic with, like, a lavender albino color, but really tiny?
Yeah, absolutely. There's actually a lot being done. As far the morphs of super dwarfs, every year you're seeing more. It used to be just maybe a couple morphs in a small super dwarf package, but now it's there's a lot being done with that. And I think consistently, yeah, absolutely, you get the higher percentage dwarf and into that, and yeah. You're going to end up with a smaller snake for sure. Now, the thing with the super dwarfs is they're really flighty. To me, they're more like a Timor or something like that that's just going to musk and piss on you. And,
great.
They're flipping around, and they're more difficult. I think it's easier to handle, you know, a regular retic, but, to each their own.
Wow. All right, that's, I don't know, a few more, and I'd rather get bit than shit on. So
with real quick, a super dwarf, you know, retic that has, like, let's say it's 75% super dwarf. Like, what size is something like that getting, and what type of enclosure are you talking? Like, are you talking, like, a 6-foot enclosure? Are you talking an 8-foot, 4-foot, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you wouldn't need to get that big. I mean, a lot of people keep, you know, mainland females in a 6-foot. You know, you can do that for so long, but once they're pushing 20 feet, I don't see how you can keep it in a 6-foot. But, something like a 75% super dwarf, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Dwarf?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wouldn't expect that. I mean, I'm not... That's not my area, but I wouldn't expect them to get, you know, more than probably 10, 12 feet tops. And you could keep that easily in a 6-foot cage.
So you're talking scrub python size?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Wow.
Not too bad.
Very manageable. Very manageable. I mean, almost like what you would see with a typical male retic, you know, something that, you know, you don't really feed it anything bigger than a 2-pound rabbit or an extra large jumbo rat because there's no need to. My island dwarfs, which is what I would compare it to, my females, I could feed them 5-pound rabbits because I'm trying to get size to them, but something like that would easily do well with a 3-pound rabbit and a 6-foot cage, sure.
I don't mean to jump in there, but what's the difference between a dwarf and a super dwarf? I mean, is that something that's size-wise? Is that a different locality?
Or is it a locality?
Yeah, there's only, as far as I know, there's a couple of islands that true super dwarfs originate from. If I tried to pronounce them, I'd butcher it, but I think,
no worries.
Okay.
You know where I'm coming from, right, Owen?
Oh,
yeah, I can barely talk. So
I think one is coyote or something along like that. The
something
Jampia,
along those lines. Yeah.
Something like that. I don't think the Jampia is a super dwarf. I think they're more of a dwarf, but as far as size goes, the super dwarfs just are tiny. They just you can absolutely tell. And I mean, if you compare a dwarf to a super dwarf to mainland, I mean, the head size is what I kind of, besides the body, you can just tell by the head. If you get a Baldago, AML, the heads on them are just, or you know, a Sulawesi, you can just tell they just have those huge heads, and this thing is going to be a monster. But you look at the dwarfs and the super dwarfs, and there's just something different about the head structure, and just, you can tell right away. So,
cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I don't know. I'm still gonna tell you. See, Eric's all about the retic right now. I'm still kind of shying away from it.
I mean, you know what it is about me? They're just, I mean, you look at, I had
you're always one of the giant pythons, but you're such a small person. So.
Yeah, it would probably be a meal.
Yes, I mean, just I look at you and it's death.
I'd have been dead by now. What are you talking about?
They're so cool, though. I mean, they're, you know, I don't know, maybe you can comment on this, Chris, but they seem to me like their intelligence is higher than your average python, you know? I mean, it looks like they think about what you're doing. It's, I don't know. Is that true, or is that something you notice?
Yeah, I mean, the best way I can describe it, and you've probably heard this before, I'm sure, is that there's something going on there. You know, there's something going on there where they know. I can't say that they recognize their keeper necessarily, but I know they recognize habit. I know they know where they're getting fed at, what door, and they're looking in that direction on a regular basis. I know that they know when it's cleaning time, and they're, if they want to be assholes about it, they will.
Right.
You know, absolutely, if you compare them to, you know, some of the short-bodied pythons, maybe, yeah, there's absolutely a little bit more going on there as far as the brain activity, as far as their intelligence goes. But.
Okay.
Yep.
So I already got enough animals that are smarter than me, so let's avoid that one altogether. So, Chris, something that kind of is one of the reasons I would rather avoid retic is the current regulations that are being added. What do you think about them? Are you kind of worried about that when it comes to keeping or breeding or even selling your retics?
Yeah, it's kind of the elephant in the room right now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Unfortunately. And,
yeah.
You know, I was listening to some of your shows from about this time last year, and you guys absolutely hit it on the head when you were talking about legislation, or not the legislation, but the regulation on these things. It's difficult, I think, because when you have people in your own industry, in your own hobby that, you know, are against it, how are you going to win? I mean, there's people that don't see it. You know, people that don't want you to have big constrictors because you're ruining it for everybody. And the thing that they don't realize is that it's going to be a trickle-down effect. I mean, okay, they might take berms. Yeah, they might take retics, but your scrub is going to be next. You know, your carpet's going to be next. It's not going to end there. So it's in everybody's best interest to work together, to just kind of band together, because we need to be able to join together and just show some support. And I think the community has, but is it enough? I don't know. I was cautiously optimistic last year, and I'm sort of in the same boat. I mean, I would hope that, being a realist, I would hope at the worst case scenario that it's kind of a permit system that's put in place, and it's just not a complete, you know, they don't get their way as far as the Humane Society of the United States, and just it's not a ban. It's, you know, a regulation on the trade, on the interstate trade, which would effectively ban the species, because you can keep them, you can breed them, but you can't transport across state lines. So who's going to want to be able to, it's going to kill the market. Would that happen? It's hard to believe that the Fish and Wildlife Commission would approve something that would just devastate such a large, economy, because the retic market is, and the boa market is phenomenal. I mean, with the morphs and the different things going on with it, it's not ball pythons, but it's not far behind, you know, and to lose that you know, all the small business that would go out of business, all the jobs that would be lost, you know, the vets, the suppliers, the feeders, it would be, you know, incredible. It would be, you know, really a shame to lose these animals, something like that. But unfortunately, that's kind of the boat we're in right now. I put a call into one of my Florida Fish and Wildlife officers who's inspected my place a couple times, and I tried to find out if he heard anything on it, which way this is going to go, and he really didn't know. So, unfortunately, I don't have any inside info on that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I would much prefer a permit system because it does kind of get the animals out of the hands of the dumbasses who aren't going to take the time to get the permit, but then allows other people who are more responsible to keep the animals and keep going. So,
yeah.
You know, hopefully that's where we end up.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, as long as that's the way I look at it with the Florida system. I mean, a lot of people don't want to go through the hoops, you know, and it's really not that much. You don't have to pay anything extra. It's just you got to chip them. You know, you have to have a disaster plan in place. You have to, you have to be subject to inspections and mm-hmm. requirements. But, you know, maybe some would argue that's the way it should be.
That's kind of like my thoughts is that I think if herpers weren't derpers, dumb herpers, we would be regulating
dumb herpers out there.
I call them derpers, but if they regulated themselves, I mean, I don't really know this per se, but this is kind of the perception. From what I've heard from people. So when it comes to retics and, you know, that you have people that are breeding them and they just sell them willy-nilly to, I mean, we've seen it at our shows up here. I guess it's probably different in Florida. I kind of think that what we're doing is you're getting a sale, but it's not a long time investment for somebody in the hobby, if that makes sense. So, you know, if you're going to set them off with a retic and that thing's going to get, you know, 20 plus feet and they're not going to be able to house it and it's, you know, ultimately it's the animal that's going to suffer. I don't know. I think you're in the retic market. Do you find that people are more responsible or...
They come and go. The only difference between retics and carpets or anything else really is the size. You know, I mean, you're talking about a bigger package, bigger feed. It's more difficult to find food. You have to have a rabbit supplier or pigs or what have you, something lined up. And not a lot of people can do that. So there's a lot of people that come and go in that
right.
market. It's not easy to clean retic shit on a regular basis. You're using a dustpan sometimes, and it's like elephant crap. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's a snake that's an active snake, and they get messy sometimes. So instead of you know, you talk about a small cage or something, you're talking about a huge area. For an 8-foot cage, it takes me anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour to clean one cage.
Wow.
So,
it's,
they come and go, man. Not everybody might want them, and they might get them as a novelty thing, and they might get a few, but to keep going year after year with them, it takes commitment, for sure. It takes... Oh, it's something that, you know, they take a lot of work. You got to plan around feeding and cleaning. You have to be careful, cautious, and that's not to say that they're not one of the most fascinating species there is that you can work with. You can take, you know, you can enjoy them. There's nothing like having a big snake and holding it and, you know, enjoying it for what it is. But they take a lot of work, so. You know, people that you find at shows that are walking around with one, you know, hopefully they treat the animal right, the way it should be treated, because they didn't ask to be put in a cage, you know. So you want to do right by them, and you want to maintain them in the most ethical way you can. And I think year by year, slowly we're weeding out those people that are that aren't worthy. You know what I'm saying?
Good.
For sure. You know, so we're getting there. Hopefully, we'll still be able to legally keep them, and it's kind of my take on it.
Yeah, I think you're kind of right in the way is that I think why retics get such a bad rap when it comes to that is because it's probably, for lack of better terms, it's easier to dispose of a smaller snake than it is a bigger snake. You know what I mean? So like, if you want to get rid of the snake because it's not necessarily something that you want, or you took on something you don't want it, whatever, it's a lot easier to ditch a 5-foot python rather than a 20-foot python too. You know what I mean? You know, so it kind of brings attention, and you know, it's kind of a shame, but.
It's hard to take a large female like that to your vet, to your local
vet. It's hard to go unnoticed with it.
Oh, man, so. I didn't even think of that. Wow.
there's a lot of logistics that go into it, so.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So, it's okay. You interrupt me again, I'll kill you. But how would you go about with responsible retic sales? I mean, obviously you put thought into selling anybody. Have you ever refused to sell a retic to anybody by feeling that they were either not knowledgeable enough or maybe even too young?
Yeah, I have. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I've refused sales. If I get the impression, you can get the impression by email, by talking to somebody, if they're experienced, if they're 15 years old, and, you know, if they have a bad reputation, there's a lot of, I wouldn't say I'm selective as far as who I sell to. I just make sure that they're over 18, they have big snake experience, and they know their local laws. But, you know, if I don't think that you're capable, I'm not going to sell to you. If I know that you have a bad reputation, that there's a lot of posts about you on the BOI or what have you, I'm not going to have my animals associated with you. You know,
right?
It's that simple.
Right. I mean, probably one of my reptile show horror stories was watching some dude. A 10-year-old kid buy a retic from the table next to me, and he was explaining to his friends as the guy was packing it up that he was going to go home and scare his mom with it. So,
yeah.
I kind of figured that ended up bad. So, but
not good.
No, I really shouldn't do that. So,
yeah. Obviously, I have... as far as the expos, I've sold to people that were out of state without a permit, and I don't know if that was, supposed to happen, but now with the spotlight on them, absolutely no way. It's got to be really on the up and up. Otherwise, you're risking, if you have an investment in them, you're risking what you got, because it's going to come back to you.
True.
If it gets in the wrong hands. So, I mean, retic is no different than a fast car or a gun that's a powerful, gun.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the wrong hands, it's dangerous. Absolutely.
Yeah. Definitely. So what would you suggest to be the caging requirements for keeping a retic responsibly throughout its life? I mean, I know... I say I hatch out my baby carpets and they go into, 5-quart tubs, but a baby retic is almost the size of a yearling carpet python at birth. So what would you do?
Well, I mean, I saw pictures actually the other day from prehistoric pets, and they have a system where they keep their babies in these really tiny little, I don't even think they're 6-quart tubs, with a little tiny belly cup in there with water. Now, who's going to argue that that doesn't work for them? Obviously it does. They had, they're one of the main breeders in the country, but
yeah.
I can't, I don't see it not with what I have. I mean, I have mine in like a hard plastic sweater box rack as babies, and I think that's enough room for them to grow for probably, I don't know, 5 months, 6 months,
okay,
maybe even, without pushing them. But, you know, it's just a matter of bumping them up in size, you know, until, you know, the appropriate size cage. You know, I think they do fine in tubs until they, you know, even males. Males can be in freedom breeder racks, stuff like that, their whole life. You know, it's just the bigger females that are breeders that they need some space. They need some, you know, a cage where they can move, where they can digest food, they can get heat. It's just something that you got to consider with them as far as the space goes. But there's a lot of people, that, like I said, they keep them in 6-foot cages their whole life. It works.
Okay.
It works for them, you know. One of the things with babies that I've been having issues with, actually, is them pushing and just, you know, tearing their face up.
Mm.
And I actually don't know why, because they have water. They're offered multiple types of food. The temperatures are in line. But there's a certain percentage of the clutch that will constantly push their face to where, they, you know, they just screw it up. And it's really frustrating, you know, to have that. I don't know why it happens. Maybe somebody else can answer that. But after, you know, the year working with them, I don't know why they do that. But, you know, they're in the appropriate size cage. If they were in something bigger, maybe they wouldn't do that. But it's just something you have to consider with retics, with babies, because they're active sleek and they do, you know, they push. And, you know, you can't really put, you know, 50 babies in huge containers, so they're kind of limited as far as space goes. But, yeah, they're no different than anything else, really. You just bump them up in size.
Okay. And what about the larger ones? Like, what do you keep your adult females in? What were the dimensions of those cages again?
8 foot by 3 foot in width, and, you know, 2 feet in height works. I mean, some, I think mine are, you know, 18 inches to 2 feet work fine.
Okay.
They don't need a ton of height. They just, the length is more important. So, you know, a lot of people keep them in something smaller, but that's what works for me. I mean, my males, I keep in 4-foot cages generally their whole life. I don't see that they need anything larger than that.
So basically, if I can lay down in the female's cage comfortably, it's good for her. So
that would be a good way to look at it, man.
Jesus, that's a lot of cage. So wow. All right. Do you do what kind of heating do you use? Use heat panels or tape? Or you live in Florida, and I should be quiet. So,
the ambient, I kind of go off of that, you know. But now the females, I have bass flights in the cages. You know, my foot cages, Eugene built. They're melamine, big industrial bulletproof tank cages, and they were built with. It's a very simple plan. But a simple idea, but it's battle tested and it works. And I bask lights on those, and you know, there's pluses and minuses with it. They will sometimes, you know, miss and hit the bulb, and that creates a problem. But I think the bass light works really well for them because it gives them some light and some heat, and they just recognize it as a heat source and something that's feeding on, you know, a 10-pound, 15-pound rabbit is going to need some additional heat. They're going to seek
right.
it out to help digest. The males, some males I have on heat as far as heat lamps go, but a lot of them I don't necessarily keep them on. Yeah, I don't want to keep them hot because my ambient is just, you know, probably 80 to 84 right now, and I don't need to keep them on any heat, really. They'd be fine.
Okay. Cool. So do you have any safety tips for anybody who's keeping retics? Because I know at the zoo when I used to have to go and deal with our female 16-footer, my safety tip was a police riot shield and buckets of water and, you know, bottles of vodka just in case and a bunch of other stuff. What would you suggest as a safety tip?
Well, I mean, the biggest safety tip is to know the, you know, that animal's behavior, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Every animal has a different personality, and, you know, you got to know their personality. You have to know when, okay, it's time to not work with this animal anymore because it's pissed off. Or, you know, it's, you know, it's chill and it's good to go. You just need to be aware. Retics are not something to be feared. You know, I don't necessarily, I'm not scared of my snakes. But the way my system's set up, I don't have, you know, staff necessarily. So I have to take some caution as far as working with them. You know, you just need to be careful. They can be sneaky sometimes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You have to always keep an eye on the female or the male if you're working with them. Hook training is important. The initial thing you want to do is disable the feeding response. So once they realize it's not feeding time, generally you're good to go as far as whatever you need to do with them. And they can still surprise you even after that. But, you know, I have some retics that I can handle. I can pre-handle. I can do whatever I want to. I trust them. Just because I know them, and then there's others that are not like that. So you just have to take extra precaution. You cannot let your guard down. You cannot be drunk, stoned, or what have you when you're out there working with them. It's just not a good combination.
Right.
And as far as a bite protocol, I've always had alcohol on hand in case that should happen. But Eugene has kind of got it in my head that I need to have a hair dryer in there because a hair dryer is not a natural thing to them. If you do get, you know, latched onto, you plug a blow dryer in and you put that heat on them and they're going to release. So I think that's a good idea to have something like that in place. You know, a lot of times water, water works the same way. You can mist them with a water bottle or something like that, and that will kind of disable that kind of response from them also.
Right. Now, would you also suggest when working with the larger females or potentially even trying to get eggs from females or something like that, never being in there alone?
Your question was grabbing eggs from them if you're alone?
I mean, would you say that, if you're working with the larger females or maybe even going for eggs, possibly having somebody there with you when you're working with the larger retics or ones you know that have bad attitudes or nesting females or something like that, having like a buddy system kind of go where somebody's there just to help out just in case. Would you kind of suggest that?
Absolutely, okay. Yeah. That's not to say that I've never pulled eggs from a female on my own. I've done it, and I'll probably do it again. You know, I mean, just you have to do. I'm not the only breeder that does that. But, you know, yeah, absolutely. It's definitely good to have backup. I pulled eggs from my Lavender Tiger, big girl, this past season, and I was attempting to get her out of the cage to weigh her, bag her and weigh her, and she proceeded to tear my room apart, so that wasn't going to happen. I thought she was worn out, but she had another thing in mind. No, that it's she wasn't biting or anything. It was just they're so big, they can just, mm-hmm. you know, get out of your control pretty quickly. And, you know, you have to have experience with them. And, you know, it wasn't a situation. It was just like, okay, this isn't going to happen right now. But having someone there, absolutely, if you're working a big snake, definitely good idea.
Okay. Cool.
Man, you talk about Lavender Tiger, man. That is one cool-looking snake.
Yeah.
I'm just saying it. I just Googled it, and good Lord. Oh, man.
Yeah.
I can see the draw.
Yeah.
I'll have to send you.
I mean,
go ahead.
You put the colors on something that gets that size, and it can be pretty amazing.
Eric's going to have like 20 retics now, pretty sure, pretty soon.
No, I could never have 20 retics. But I guess, well, as far as retic morphs go, I'm kind of, let's say I'm a newbie, and I don't know, maybe some of our listeners are in on it or know what's going on, but I have a couple questions. I mean, first of all, how did the retic genetics, are they cut and dry? Are we looking at codominant, incomplete dominant, dominant, recessive, or is it more of a polygenic type of thing, or is it a mix?
Yeah, for the most part, it's a lot of recessive, codominant, you know, type of thing. But there are some of the higher-end things that Nerd has produced as far as the orange ghost stripe, the cows. I don't know if you guys have seen those.
Yeah.
Then you're starting to get into some weird genetics that you're talking about, like some +3 type of stuff where, you know, you breed an orange ghost stripe to a phantom stripe, and you might get you're going to get blue-eyed Lucy's, and then, you know, a certain percentage of cows, and it can get pretty complicated with some of that stuff. But for the most part, you know, sunfires are codominant, and, you know, the alpinos are recessive, of course. So it's all been pretty straightforward until kind of recently when you get into these really, really weird high-end type of morphs, and then it gets kind of crazy.
Right.
So I'm not, you know, I'm not exactly the best one to speak to that kind of thing, because you're talking about some really expensive stuff there. But, yeah, it can get kind of weird.
So one of the things that you talked about, the orange ghost stripe retic, I mean, that thing is just, that's insane. That's crazy looking.
Mm-hmm.
Man, good Lord. What about, like, I'm looking at some of the things that that you produced. Golden Child is one that I've heard people say a lot. I never really researched it much. But then I saw this is the one that you said, Owen, that was pretty, because it's up on the Facebook page, the Platinum Golden
pretty.
Child. I'm
yeah.
assuming that you produced that one, right? The one that was on your website?
Or is that one? That is actually an animal I got from Vital Exotics. And
okay.
Nerd produced that, and it was a really kind of a special clutch. So I was kind of lucky to pick that male up, kind of a reduced pattern, but just an incredible, incredible-looking animal. I mean, it just freaking glows. It's just amazing.
Yeah, that's nuts, man. Really pretty.
Yeah.
So how does that genetics work?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a Golden Child Platinum. So, you know, Golden Child is a co-dominant, and then you're putting a Platinum, which is another co-dominant morph on top of that, and I guess the super form of the Platinum is the Ivories. So you can really do a lot with something that's a double morph like that. And it's I don't think the Ivory Golden Sobs have really been produced to any extent to this point. So, you start getting the 2-3 gene animals, and it's just, crazy type of outcome with that. I love the Golden Child morph. I think it's such a dominant morph that you breed it to anything, and it just takes over. And you probably appreciate this with the white lips. It's just something that's the uniform color with that iridescence has just always been really appealing to me. The heads on Golden Childs are just incredible. It's just so cool because it's got like a cross and it's a lighter color. So it kind of stands out from the body, and their eyes are usually silver or light blue. They're really, really impressive snakes. And I like to think the possibilities with that morph. So I've kind of built my collection around the purples and the Golden Childs. So that's kind of the direction that I like to go with it.
Yeah, if I had my way and I could own, have some retics and, space wasn't an option and all that, that Platinum Golden Child and a regular Golden Child, that's kind of...
Yeah, I kind of like the regular Golden Child. I kind of like the regular Golden Child better. They kind of got that dark feel to them. I like that, so...
Yeah, well, Eric, you can always get males and keep them on the smaller side.
There you go.
That's true.
Now you have no excuse.
I would even enjoy just keeping them, man. It's such a cool looking snake. I mean, man, I don't know. And then, so let me ask you this question. So, okay, when we look at ball python morphs, right, they start off beautiful, and as they age, they kind of, fade with age, or so to speak. You look at carpet pythons or Morelia, they kind of hatch out drab, and then they kind of, get nicer with age. Where does the retics fall into that? Are they, right out of the egg, boom, beautiful? And, I really haven't seen ugly adults, but what's your thoughts?
Yeah, they I don't think the color just changes, They don't get any uglier or any more vibrant for the most part. They just change, If you're looking at let's take a purple, for example. As babies, they come out, orange and purple, kind of, when I say purple, it's more of a dark gray. And as they grow, that orange turns into yellow. And that purple, it depends on the animal, but it really turns, some of them can actually turn purple, or some could be just more of a gray. But the colors just kind of change a little bit. Depending on what it is. As far as, the Golden Childs, they kind of stay the same. I mean, it's a bigger package, The orange ghost stripes are interesting because you brought them up. They are one that they start out really, the colors are crazy as babies. And as they grow, it's kind of the same thing. That orange turns into like a yellow or a gold. I don't think it's not like carpets, and it's more probably like bloods, I would say.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Something like that.
All right. Yeah, because it's funny. I was just over a guy, Matt Minatola, who lives local, and he has a couple retics, and he also one of the things that blew my mind, and I don't know why I never put two and two together, was, like Owen said earlier, the size of the babies. So he hatched out a clutch, and he opens the drawer, and I'm like, so what are these? These are what, yearlings? And he's like, no, they just hatched out a couple months ago. And I was like, holy shit, that's a big thing. You know? Like, oh, man. When you're dealing with, like, when you're dealing with chondros and carpets, it's kind of like, oh, wow. That's a big snake. But
big baby.
One of the things he was showing me is exactly what you're saying, and it's was with his Bloods and his Borneos, is how they, you know, look when they're younger. And it's not necessarily that they get uglier or, you know, drab out, because some carpets, they will drab out when they get older. But, man, his Bloods and his short tails, they still had that they just look different. You're absolutely right. But they were still, like, the contrast was still there. The colors were still there. They were just a different color. But, man, they were hot. So, cool. So what's the most popular morph as far as retics go? What's, like, the hot one?
Well, I think the there's a lot being done with motleys. There's always, you know, albino golden shells are always hot. They're always in demand. Let's see. I mean, it really depends on your price range, you know. I mean, there's so much out there now.
Right.
I mean, it's not all pythons. It's not like 3,000 morphs, but, you know, it's gaining. I mean, it's getting there. I mean, the way some of the guys are putting these new things out, it's incredible. I think, you know, the Sunfires, not the normal Sunfires, but Sunfires in combination with other stuff is, you know, like Sunfire albino golden childs. That's just something where you just make colors pop even more, you know, adding something like that onto it. You know, as far as demand goes, I think the ivories they were popular for a while, and then they kind of, you know, the price went down on them a little bit. Just trying to think. The cows and the piebalds are out of most people's price range, but that's, you know, the stuff that Bob Clark is hatching out is just ridiculous. So there's definitely something for everyone.
I just Googled a lavender albino Sunfire golden child. And I'm going to post this picture over on Moraye Python Radio page.
I'm waiting for this one.
Oh, yeah. My God. Where do you see this thing? It's insane. It's like an orange snake with... Oh, my God. Do you
calm down and post.
I did. Wow.
See, I like the look of the piebald retics. If I were to jump into a retic, it would probably be one of those. But I'll wait until, like, you know, I don't have to sell my car to get one. So.
Yeah. Take a second mortgage out.
Yeah, that's great.
Just get hats, you know.
There you go.
Yeah.
Aaron, what the hell is this picture? Double heads. Because I assume now once the piebalds come out, I assume the next step is to make everything a piebald. So piebald this, piebald that. So.
Man,
one day we'll probably see him at $500 or something like that.
There you go. Exactly. It'll be like, thank you for coming to the reptile show today. Here's your piebald retic with your ticket. I mean, that happens with everything, right? I mean, I'm pretty sure at one point people were like, would you like this Burmese python? And when you said no, they just left it on your table and ran away. So.
That's a beautiful
one. Throwing cycles.
Yeah, I know. So.
So switching gears from retics to another species that is actually, this is more something that I'm interested in more so than Owen, probably because it looks like a ball python. He's
probably if we're sticking to the schedule, probably, yeah.
Is Angolans. And I know, again, we talked about them a little bit on the last time you were on, but what do you got going on with them?
I have only to maintain a group of Angolans. I just, you know, going to shows years ago, they were just one of those things that were always a goal, kind of an unattainable goal to actually have one of those things. And, you know, I invested in a group a long time ago, and they've been really, really terrific snakes. They produce for me, and I've always maintained a group. Right now, I don't have a huge group of them. I had a buyer for them recently, so, but I have some breeders that I still work with, and they're just Angolans are one of those super easy snakes to keep. I mean, it's just they're not difficult. They're very tolerant of a lot of keeper error, of different changes in their setup. They're just easy. Yeah, I don't really keep any extra heat on them. I don't do anything unusual. You can keep them on just about any substrate. The only thing, the females, as far as breeding goes, they kind of tell you when they're ready. If they're not ready to breed, then, you know, it's just not going to happen. So I find that my females would generally go every other year. But they're a really unique snake, and they've become a lot more affordable, you know, recently, so
yeah.
Last few years. So they're accessible now, and I think everybody that's really a snake enthusiast should keep some at some point.
They really surprised me that they're not as popular, because they seem like they're kind of like, I don't know, maybe I've never kept them. This was another one that I don't know if I fully appreciated it. I remember when I was younger, I seen them at reptile shows and thought they were cool, but I think that I was, you know, my reptile hipster was coming out, and then I wanted them because nobody really had them. So it was kind of like, you know, it's kind of like, oh, I want that because nobody has it. But when I saw them at, I think it was maybe it was Ben had him at.
Ben had him at ICAS, which we won't talk about how the Angolan slipped past the arboreal symposium part of that thing. I mean, that time I saw an eminent tree, but
and I think
I
think I saw him at Hamburg too when he split the table with you, Owen. But
yeah, he brought him to a few places.
I think it was one of those things where you had it in your hand, and to me it felt like it bridged the gap between a ball python and, say, an African rock python. It was kind of like, okay, I get it. This is the in-between snake, you know? And okay. I'm surprised that more ball python people didn't say, okay, well, here's something that's similar to what I keep, but it's something different.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
To me, they're more like a bridge between a ball and a rough scale.
Okay. Because of the keeled scale?
Like that. Well, because they have beaded scales.
Right.
Yeah, they're beaded in the end. NBA, yeah.
They're like a rough scale, except they're terrestrial. And the head looks like a ball python, but that's kind of where it ends. I mean, they get larger. You know, my adults are probably over 6 feet. And they're super active, and they're just they're different. They're feeding machines, and you know, they're just super cool.
Okay. Is there different lines that are out there, or is it all just from the same? Because there's nothing that's being imported into the U.S., right?
Not anymore. There's, I believe, a European line, and there's some zoo lines. Casey Lasik, of course, is kind of a pioneer breeder here in the States. Kind of an interesting thing with Angolans is I had a Canadian buyer, actually, that wanted a group my babies from last year. So we kind of he was kind of committed to this. I was surprised, but I didn't think it was going to happen or go through because the possibility of finding the original CITES paperwork into the States was slim to none. But I worked with Michael Cole on it, and, you know, we, I had to get the original studies, and I contacted Casey Lasik, and he happened to find the original studies from years ago that came from Sweden, and that was pretty neat to get that, and just it actually went through, so
wow.
that was pretty neat. It's not often that they're exported, but it worked out. I had to wait 6 months, but, you know, it's kind of cool.
That is awesome.
Very cool.
Okay. Hey. So I guess we're getting into the Morelia portion of this episode of Morelia Python Radio. Weird. Can you tell us what current Morelia projects you're working with, Chris?
Yeah, I had some. I have a small group of carpets that I work with, and I was just kind of mixing and matching this past season and with the Jags.
Mm-hmm.
So I paired up some 75% Aryan Jaya Jags with some jungles and diamond jungles to just to see what I could get, and it's pretty cool. You know, the babies, you know, are a lot of variability with them.
Mm-hmm.
The one clutch is really neat because I don't know if you guys experienced this or if this is that unusual with carpets, but I had two Jags out of, I think, 25, and the rest were like regular sibs of jungles. I didn't really understand how that happened, but I didn't get any Lucys out of any of them. Is weird.
Mm-hmm.
Usually I would get at least a couple, but so I have those Jags that I'm working with, the Aryan Jaya's, of course, and I got another clutch of those this year, and they're just, you know, super sweet. I love those things, and just they look really good. So
oh yeah, those GQIJs, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're nice.
they're very nice. Some jungle carpets that I'm still working with to kind of refine the line, and the 75% diamond jungles, I'm just holding a lot back from that and just trying to produce those because those are always, you know, kind of in demand. Just basic stuff, you know, nothing crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But right now I'm just trying to get all these things fed, you know. 200 new snakes in the room, just trying to get them all started.
Yeah, it's this time of year. How about the white whips? Did you get anything with the golds this year?
No, I actually I didn't pair them up
mm-hmm.
this year. It's just one of those weird deals where, you know, the female was ready and then the male wasn't, and then
right.
the temperature, the cycle just didn't jive this year for some reason, so, you know, I'm definitely going to pair them up, you know, next season, but they're doing well.
Cool.
You know, so we'll definitely be working on that again.
Best of luck there.
And Steve Tillis actually had a clutch. So
I know. Everybody's getting white lips but Owen.
Little female,
so.
Too.
Uh-huh. So, all over the place. Anyway, Eric, what's going on?
We have a caller, 845 area code. I think he has a question for you, Chris. Good, you're on the air.
What's up, Christopher?
Hey, Tim.
How you doing?
This is Tim up in New York. He's a very knowledgeable herper and fan of the show.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
Welcome, Tim.
Thanks. Christopher doesn't like to take my advice, but I can't take credit for this. But you guys earlier were talking about, you know, safety precautions with big snakes. And actually something that I've used for small snakes, rubbing alcohol in a spray bottle will remove just about any biting snake and turn it into a flighty snake.
Oh, really?
It's some advice that I got from Chris's buddy, Bob Guerriere of Ancient Reproduction. And he always, you know, kept some around with some of the big berms that he was working with at the time. And I actually recently even had a corn snake, a female corn snake, that for some reason bit and wanted to eat a male corn snake. And I put a couple drops on her head, and she spit them out right away. And I'd even tried putting water, cold water on her, and she didn't care. She was still trying to eat them. And a couple drops of rubbing alcohol, and she spit them out right away.
Wow.
I haven't seen any ill effects long term from it, but it's something people could try if they're worried about, you know, getting that feeding response from a big female retic.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, hopefully you don't have to go there in the first place, you know, because you're probably going to the hospital at that point, but, you know, yeah, the point is to definitely, whatever you got to do to get them released, and, you know, alcohol is definitely a proven way, so.
Wow. Cool.
What is it like with a retic bite?
I imagine
you're,
pain.
Yeah, you're pretty screwed up, right?
Yeah, luckily I haven't had anything crazy happen. You know, I've had one that, you know, kind of pulled me in the cage, maybe 12-foot female. And, you know, that just, once they realized that it wasn't rabbit blood, they kind of let go. But it took a little while.
Oh.
The scars go away. You know, the pain is there, but it goes away. So,
Chris and I worked at Eugene's together many, many moons ago, and I got a bite, feeding response bite out of a decent sized berm, on my hands while we were working there, and you'd be very surprised. You know, I don't know how much of it is shock, but it didn't hurt all that much, and I could feel the snake's teeth on my bones in my hand. And their teeth are so needle sharp. And like Chris said, once it realized that I wasn't a rabbit, it slowly released me. And even at the end, it pushed its jaws forward and pulled its teeth out without ripping my skin.
That was
and,
nice.
You know, very. Obviously, you know, I didn't pull away at all. And it, you know, and the whole time, I was watching my blood drip down its mouth and pool in the bottom of the cage. But I don't know if I was more half asleep or in shock or whatever, but I didn't pull away at all. And luckily, I got away with, you know, basically with nothing.
Tim, you're not doing anything to help my future sales here, man.
Yeah.
It was
it's
a burn.
Not going
reason.
Well. Damn.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, unfortunately, you know, where he's at, you know, he can't keep big snakes, but I'm sure he would if he could.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Heck yeah. Heck yeah. Oh. Yeah, New York, you can't have any of that stuff. That sucks.
Nah. All right. Stick to the medium-sized bleeders. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Cool.
God.
Any other, you got another question or?
That's it. Are you guys still live or is this the recording portion?
No, we're in the recording section now.
Yeah. Oh, we are?
Can you just leave me on hold then?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Yeah,
no problem.
All right, have a
good
night, guys. Thanks, Chris.
You too.
Thank you. Good talking to you, man. Tim actually turned me on to your show years ago.
Oh, yeah? Cool.
Excellent. We fully support
Look at that,
things.
Owen. Look at that,
yes.
Owen. We actually have
I know.
Fan.
I won today.
Oh,
who actually wants
cool.
to hear us talk? So.
Speaking of which, are you going on 3 years or four years with the show?
3 years in October.
That's congrats. That's, you know, that's really phenomenal that you take the time out to do this every week. I mean, you know, my hat's definitely off to you guys. It can't be easy every week to have that, you know, to have that commitment to it. So, you know, in all seriousness, that's great. I appreciate what you guys do. Not easy.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Eric,
I mean,
is my longest lasting relationship. So.
You guys are connected by the hip for now.
Yeah, sorry about that. I had to do it, yeah.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yep.
Oh, man. So I thought we would throw in for, like, the last section of stuff. Actually, I don't even know if we hit on this. Is there any carpet stuff that you wanted to get into? I know that we were talking before and you were talking about saying that you wanted to get into some other stuff. Is there anything that catches your eye? I'm just curious as far as, you know, coming from the carpet breeder point to see what somebody that's maybe getting into some of the morphs or whatever, what catches your eye?
Yeah, I definitely, you know, I've been talking about it for a long time, expanding the carpets, and the inlands are something that's definitely high on my list. It's not a morph, but I just think they're really, really neat. I'd like to get some zebra stuff in at some point and work them in. The albino stuff that you're working with is crazy. So I think that's just, you know, you're just like a mad scientist with that stuff. And well, definitely high on my list
today. You are correct. So
they're pretty cool, right, Owen?
Yeah, I admit to nothing. But if I hypothetically say yes, they were kind of badass, I mean, you know, they're horrible little mutt creatures, but, oh, man, they were pretty. So.
Yeah. I mean, the Darwins, just, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, I don't know, is the caramels, is that something that is, you've gotten a good reaction to, Owen, as far as that?
Somewhat.
The caramels?
Somewhat. Yeah, people tend to like the super caramels a little bit more. Because they're a little bit more eye-catching when they, you know, shed out and become like nothing but patternless gold with a little bit of some jag patterns on them. They usually eat them up. And it's really hard to pick my holdbacks right now. So, yeah, I'm liking them.
Yeah. I mean, I'm happy with the bread and butter stuff. You know, I love just refining the jungles and you know, the diamond stuff. And I think, you know, jags are just, you know, some of the stuff I've seen offered, it's incredible. I'm like, that looks like a, you know, on Nick's site, it just looks like a $1,500 snake, and it's like $300. I mean,
yep.
I guess it's just how the market goes. But, carpets are, there's a lot of stuff on my wish list. But, yeah, if the retics go by the wayside, yeah, I guess I'll be dumping a bunch of stuff in that. So, we'll see.
Well, hopefully it doesn't come to that, and you just include the carpets with the retics. So, but
yeah. Well, fortunately for you, you have stuff that I want, and I have stuff that you want.
Chris, don't listen. This is how he gets me with things, okay?
See that?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, they're cool stuff. You know, I was showing Owen tonight, and I didn't really even talk about this on the air because I wanted to show him tonight, but I hatched out what I believe is a caramel albino jag. And I was showing Owen the difference between, an albino jag and then what I think is a caramel albino jag. And, man, it was cool, right, Owen? You could see, like, the contrast.
Definitely see a difference in the contrast around the pattern of the caramel animal, the caramel albino versus the normal albino. And I know they're fairly young, and they probably only shed, what, once or twice?
Once, yeah.
Once. It with carpet python babies, I the second shed for a carpet python baby is when you really start seeing color just pop and things start kind of showing themselves. So it's definitely very cool to see how they're going to progress. But I almost kicked him and ran out the door with both of the albinos. So I will admit it was tempting, but
yeah.
they were awesome looking. Them and the diamonds and everything else you flaunted in front of me that I wanted to take. So
diamonds, the inlands.
Diamonds, the inlands.
Yeah.
The granite jaguar.
Cool stuff.
Yep.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, when we talked before, Chris, you were telling me that you had started doing some exporting, and I was curious to know, is that something that you're pushing towards as far as like a big part of your business? Because it seems like a lot of, you know, breeders are taking that under the wing. And how difficult is it?
Yeah, it's a step. I think that's kind of where you know you have to go towards in the global market. At this point, yeah, I'm applying for the permit as far as the export
mm-hmm.
goes, and I think it's a scary thing, you know, because you're talking about, you know, international market, and shipping overseas is a whole different ballgame, you know, as far as that goes, and it can be pretty daunting. But it can be done. It can be done right, and you just have to, you know, learn from mistakes, and you have to know how to set it up. And it's something that I think with things that are getting regulated, you might need to stay viable. The thing that's always been kind of prohibitive to me is just the language barrier. I mean, how are you going to set something up with somebody in Japan or China? But
mm-hmm.
apparently, you know, I think most of the globe speaks English, and there's ways around that. So it's
Google Translate will help.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
there's ways to do it. So you know, definitely looking in that direction and kind of get my feet wet on that. So you know, it's just I think. You know, working with someone that's experienced as far as exporting and importing it is a definite help. And, you know, it's something that we need to look at if we're going to, you know, be breeders in the future, because who knows what's going to happen with the American market. You know,
mm-hmm.
Now, carpets, it's
yeah.
a different story, but.
Yeah.
Where do you,
you know,
see
as far
the
as
future?
Exporting.
Right. Where do you see the future of, you know, breeding reptiles for a living, these, you know.
Well, I guess it all kind of depends on the regulations, unfortunately. I think, you know, for us, I don't think we're big on ball pythons, but I know that market is, you know, it seems like it's kind of reached saturation point, and people are starting to look at other species to work with. So, you know, the reptile hobby is there's something for everybody. That's the neat thing about it. And herpers that are coming into it, they're more sophisticated today. So there's, you know, as long as we can continue to breed the niche stuff, stuff that's not being imported, shavus
mm-hmm.
and just rings and different things that are not, you don't see all the time. I think that's because, you know, the other stuff is always going to be there, I think. But I think we can, you know, it's important to focus at least something in your collection on some of those niche animals, you know.
Yeah,
even ball python breeders are full time. I mean, they have stuff that they play around with. You know, teamer pythons. Just you know, have something, have a group of something different. So keep things interesting and work with something that's you know, you don't see all the time, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah, I mean that's kind of what keeps the, you know, the hobbyist. Part of you going, I think, if you're doing it as a business full time.
And you know, with ultrasound, I mean, that's really kind of changed the game, you know, because a lot of the stuff that was difficult or has never been bred, it's doable now. I mean, you know, we know there's breeders that rely on ultrasound for everything as far as when they pair up. So, you know, that's it kind of, as a matter of fact, I think if you're not using ultrasound, you're not playing on a level field. You know, it's just my opinion. But there, I think of all the stuff that I've missed out on over the years, which if I knew that follicles were at a certain size, I would have got, you know, eggs from that. So
let me ask you this question. When you're using an ultrasound in that capacity, right, are you just randomly going and picking females and picking them out and ultrasounding, and then you see that the, you know, their follicles are a certain size? Do you see any kind of pattern, or is it just like a random, you know, oh, today I'm going to pick this girl?
Well, it's I don't have an ultrasound, so I'm just – make that clear.
Oh,
I don't have one, but
yeah.
I have a friend. I have a friend that does. So,
right.
You know, it's just a matter of getting a baseline and seeing where the growth. You know, if you monitor every month and you can have a baseline from that and you can tell from that as far as when to pair up. It's invaluable. You know.
I keep trying to convince Owen that we should go in one together, you know.
I told you
so,
I would, but the problem, money, dude, need money to do that.
Yes.
I'm sorry, let me reach into my wallet and pull out a couple $1 million. Go for it.
Get one for a couple thousand, I would think.
Shut up.
So
I'm filling my head with truth.
What'd you say?
Hmm?
It pays for itself, I think, usually, after the initial investment.
Yep.
Yep.
So, you know, you said you're hatching out all these babies, the retics and big clutches and whatnot. And, you know, I thought you would be the guy to talk to about being efficient when it comes to cleaning and record keeping and, you know, all the, I guess, what would be tedious jobs that if you're not doing it efficiently, you could spend days. You know, I mean, I guess we all do, but, you know, so maybe you could share some tips, and I know you probably have a lot from working with Eugene for as long as you have, but what would be, like, some tips you would share with us on how to – let's start with cleaning.
Well, I mean, it's just – I think keeping it as simple as possible. You know, with one thing I found with baby retics is I use paper. I found newspaper is something that they get ink. I don't think it's a health issue. I just think that they get ink, and you get an albino that's really light or something, and they just look like crap when they get ink all over them when it gets wet. So paper, you know, tubs, containers, they're really clean, but they tear it up. So I'm actually going, you know, aspen mulch, they end up getting that all in the water dish, and it's a giant mess. So I was going towards Cellzor. Pellets. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that.
I am. It's like rolled newspaper, kind of a kitty litter substitute or something like that.
Yeah, it's like larger pellet-sized material, and it's a heavier substrate, so they can't move it around, and it's super absorbent, so you can just spot clean. I think that's something that, you know, is going to help cut down time. Unfortunately, they're kind of out of production right now, so I don't know how much of that stuff is available, but I think, you know, spot cleaning is something that can save you time for sure, but you have to just be, you know, recognize that it's got to be changed out or it's going to get moldy and funky after a while.
Right.
You know, paper is tedious and it takes a lot of time to clean that out. So, like you said, you could spend days out there going through 100, 200 snakes doing it like that. You know, having the rack near your sink is definitely a big time saver. You know, the less motion walking that you have to do, it's something that's really simple, but I think it, you know, you can look at if, you know, you don't set your room up right. So that's where having racks on wheels can help. And just recognizing, okay, where in my room am I going to have, you know, 100, 200, 500 babies set up? Is it something that I can navigate here and reduce my walking distance, something like that?
Right.
Just something to consider. Disposable cups. That way you don't have to go back and forth cleaning every single water dish. And just having everything kind of centrally located. I use carts, and, you know, that way I have everything within reaching distance and, you know, little things like that.
Okay. What about record keeping? How do you go about record keeping? Are you in the technology with, like, what's that, Herper Pro, or are you
Index? My Herp.
Index card guy?
I guess I'm old school. I mean, I just, you know, for my colony that I established, I use breeding cards. And, you know, for babies and stuff like that, I use stickers and write, you know, feeding records on that. And, you know, I don't know. I guess there's maybe easier ways to do it, but for me, that's just what always has worked. And, you know, color-coded system is definitely helpful. That way you can, at a glance, tell exactly what you're working with and, you know, what is maybe needs more attention, something that's good feeder, what have you. I think color-coded sticker system works, at least for me it does. And
Okay. So if you have, like, a bad feeder, you're putting, like, I don't know, say a red dot or something on that tub and kind of points you in the direction to sort of know who you have to give a little more attention to. That's a good idea.
Whatever, you know, you can put on that container to make it separate it from the other snakes. So you know, okay, this is something I have to keep an eye on. Just kind of basic stuff like that.
Right.
And, you know, that's pretty much it on that I can think of. I know there's identification. There's different ways of identifying, you know, snakes by their tail scales. And, you know, OS did something. They're doing something with just scanning the tail, and that way they can ID it that way instead of microchipping. And there's so much technology out there, you know. But I'm just kind of old school in the way I approach it, you know.
Yeah, me too. I like index cards and that kind of stuff. And I tried that other stuff, but it seemed like it was too tedious. You had to pull out your phone. And
yeah.
I guess if I was, like, I think at work, like, I have these, they're called Telzon guns, where you just kind of have, like, it scans a barcode. And then you can operate it from there. If I had that kind of thing, it might be quicker, but I don't know. That's a lot of money.
You want to work, we can reprogram it.
Yeah, so. When an index card costs, like, you know, maybe a penny a piece or something. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
How about feeding? Do you do anything special as far as feeding and as far as babies or, you know, do you feed all in the same day, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I'll go into a group, you know, each day. I find to try to feed everything in one day is just, it's monumental and it can be overwhelming. to try to get everything, you know, done in at one shot. So you know, definitely breaking it up helps. Doing one species one day and another the other. You know, I kind of made a rookie mistake this past weekend. I put some, I'm trying to get these baby carpets to feed, so I put these mouse, I thought they were mouse crawlers, but they ended up being a little bigger. So I left them in there for a little bit longer, and I didn't check on them and, until the next day, and then half of them ended up in the water. So it was like just a giant colossal mess, and I should have known better, but
right.
Yeah, so the room smelled like friggin' rat mouse death.
Yay!
You know that smell as soon as you walk through your door. You're like, oh.
Yeah. Then you really like, where is it? So
the unglamorous side, you know,
yeah.
Something that you don't see on Facebook.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah. No one's ever taken
true.
A picture of that. Mm. Yeah.
Right.
But it happens.
What about? Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. So, I think the other thing that I guess the last thing we'll hit on is. You know, what are your thoughts as far as, you know, we're starting to see more of these less bred species in captivity starting to be bred. Maybe not 100% success, but we're starting to see a push in that way. And dealing with some of the more difficult species to breed in captivity, what do you think, why do you think we're seeing such a rise in success?
I think it's probably two factors. I think it's kind of like what we touched on. I think it's people that, you know, the market is so kind of saturated with ball python breeders that are looking for an outlet and something alternative to that. That's one reason, and the other reason is ultrasound. That has really kind of changed the game. So I think those two things have made these difficult to breed species or, you know, something that you can realistically work with. And I mean, it doesn't mean that you just put the machine in there and you, okay, put them together and bam, you got snakes. I mean, you still have to know the species. It's, you still have to, you know, have all the husbandry in place and environmental cues and things like that. But, I think it's definitely changed it as far as making it more realistic to breed a lot
right.
of stuff. So people are, you know, thinking, okay, well, there's, you know, there's a possibility here. I'm not just going to get this all python and just keep it as a pet or something to have fun with, you know. You know, you get it to size and you can get maybe a return if that's what you're looking for. Just, you know, the just having a snake, the beauty of having something different of, you know, experiencing. So I had all this at one point, and they're incredible. I mean, they're just every, you know, different. That's a great thing about snakes is that they're just so different and variable, all of them. So you know, why stick with one thing when there's just so much out there? So
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's,
yeah,
that's
who wants
kinda...
to go up to a table and just see one thing, you know?
Yeah, I kind of changed my thoughts on that because for a while I kind of thought, you know, I'm gonna sort of specialize in this one. Well, I mean, carpets are kind of weird because you kind of have, like, to me, you kind of have, like, groups within the group, you know? But still... Like, I know some people just specialize in jungles, and then there's some people that just do, you know, morphs, and I kind of like the whole mix, but I think if you want to keep it fresh, I'm always trying to learn new things. I think that it's kind of important to have experience with as many different species. I'm just speaking specifically pythons at the moment, but, you know, as you get, you know, I think that you'll be you'll be more well-rounded as a keeper, and I think ultimately you'll be more successful as a keeper
yeah.
and a breeder, you know?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, I would think you should challenge yourself, too, as a herper. I mean, if you're successful with one type, you know, and you can pretty much do it with your eyes closed, I think the next step would be find something new and interesting that is, you know, challenging to you. So you've evolved with your collection.
Exactly. Yeah.
So.
Exactly. I mean, there's nothing wrong with specializing or focusing. I think, you know, as you grow with your collection, you know, you have to do that. You can't you can't have, you know, 20 different things if you're a small or mid-sized breeder, because you're, you know, I think you have to have a specialized focus, especially if you want to be able to market yourself. You have to be known for something. Like you said, the more hands you can put on different species, the better off you're going to be. You know, I mean, I've, over the years, like most people, I've kept all kinds of different stuff, mandarin rat snakes, rubber boas, red tails, just, you know, lots of different stuff. I just have found that it naturally evolved into what I have now, which is mainly retex carpets and those few niche species. So, you know, it's just, I found it to be, okay, I'm just kind of spinning my wheels. It's great to have these things, these different things. Rubber boas are really cool little snakes.
Right.
But, you know, where am I going with this? So it's eventually space becomes an issue. You know, you have to consider that and your time that you're out there. You know, how much time do you want to put into cleaning and feeding a group of something that you're really not focused on? So, but... yeah, it's just, you got to work with, what's been said, you got to work with what you enjoy, because you're, you know, that's what you're going to be spending time with, that's what you're going to be cleaning, and we're not talking about a large-scale breeder that has a staff in place, that's a different thing altogether.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But if you're doing it yourself, then, you know, you're the one cleaning the crap and putting the time into it, do what you enjoy doing, because otherwise it gets stale. You're going to get tired of it, and, you know, it's going to be not a good experience. And,
yeah,
you know, you just, that's kind of my look on it.
Yeah. I agree. Have you found that, curious, since you've kept these different types of species, have you found that, like, let's say that retics are your passion, your one that you're so excited about, and maybe when you were first keeping them or something, have you found that another species has ultimately taught you how to keep retics better?
It's a good question. I think you take a little bit from everything, you know. I had hognose snakes at one point, and it just didn't go well. I just didn't jive with it.
Right.
You know, it's just such a micro organism to me, you know?
Yeah.
It's too tiny.
Baby chondros are something they're so fragile and.
Oh, they're way tiny.
They're just, you know, but, it's just, you just got to take something from everything and you can apply what you learn. I mean, you learn something every day you go out there, you know. There's times you don't want to go out there, but you just get in there and you start working. And, you know, I tell my wife sometimes, I'm like, all right, I'll be back in like 15 minutes, and it's like 3 hours later.
Been there, yeah.
That's a normal type of thing.
So I guess there's no anthill pythons in your future, huh?
Yeah, they're neat little snakes, right? But never say never. I kind of like the sunbeams and something like that. But no, I mean, you know, it's just time becomes an issue at some point. So, you know, you got to focus.
Yeah, I've always had a fascination with, like, with big snakes. I mean, Burmese are probably one of my favorites. And, you know, I kind of found, like, that balance with the carpets. But I would love to have, even if I just had one, just to have,
They were such a cool snake. So that's kind of like why I'm sort of like retics as far as like something that you could keep smaller and just, even if it's just as a pet, they're just cool. That big snake feel, you know what I mean? And that's kind of what recently I've been looking at blood pythons and short tails, and they kind of have that big snake feel and a small snake package, I guess.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the great things about snakes in particular as far as reptiles goes. You can work with so many different kinds, so many different body types. You can work with a huge animal 1 minute, and then you go into something that's really fragile and small and delicate the next, and then it kind of keeps it interesting.
Sure, sure, absolutely. Cool. What else you got, Owen? Anything?
I got nothing. Although I do think that you should get anthills, because then you got two sides of the spectrum. You got the really teeny guys, and you got the massive ones. So, you know, it'd be funny. That's all I'm getting at.
The largest python and the smallest.
Exactly. It's a selling point right there. It practically sells itself. So.
Wow.
Nice.
You could fit the whole clutch of anthill pythons inside
the egg. Shell. Oh. In the shell of one of the retics, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's pretty wild.
Yep. That or for kicks, you take one retic egg and put it in with the anthill mom and see if she tries to incubate the one egg, like wrapping it up.
Oh, man. That's just amazing.
Yeah. Mm. See, now it's science. Now we have to do it. So,
Chris, what do we got? What's your website, and how do we get in touch with you? You got all your email and all that, in case somebody wants to check out what you got going on.
Yeah, website is Chris. Website is mysticreptiles.com. Email is Chris at mysticreptiles. I'm on Facebook. I'm really happy. I just got like 120 likes, so I'm super proud about that. Yeah, no, I'm kidding. I just kind of got more into Facebook, but I like the balance there. I've heard some people that say, well, it's websites are outdated, but I think having a website is a good anchor for your business. You know, there's some people that don't use websites, but and it works for them, but I think it's good to have something that's like an anchor out there, you know, since most of our sales are over the internet, something that has your, you know, your policies, your procedures, and your terms, and just a way of reaching you. So, but, yeah, that's basically it. I'm very accessible and spend one-on-one time with anybody, and I'm not a huge operation, so can afford to spend, you know, have customer service as a priority, and you know, look forward to working with anybody on anything that I'm working with. So.
Cool. I will say that talking to you at all, and this will just go to show you the importance of a website, is when I go and look at your website, it seems sharp, it's polished. You know, your logo's sharp. You know, the way your website's set up is nice. It's clear. You can read it. Nice pictures. You know, it's really looks very professional. And I think that's what people maybe miss, I think, when they just have a Facebook page as their website type of thing, because you can't get that same feel. And I think if I didn't know you or I didn't talk to you and I was going to buy a snake, I would buy a snake from you before I would buy a snake from somebody that just had a Facebook page. Even though maybe the person with the Facebook page is a better breeder, or you're the better breeder, or whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, your image is everything. And when I would click on what you got going on, I would think, wow, this guy, if this guy takes this much time to make this look sharp, he must spend a lot of time with his animals and takes the extra steps to make sure that he has success, and ultimately I will have success. So that's just my first impressions when I look at your site. So
I appreciate that, man. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. So cool.
I mean,
well,
it's like, you know, what Robin said, you know, you, there's only so much time you could spend looking at stuff on the internet. At some point, you have to get out and do it. You know, so I think you can waste so much time on the internet going through different things, and but you have to go out and do it eventually. But you know, the internet, it's an internet business for the most part. I mean, it's great to go out to the expos and meet people and shake hands and talk snakes and have that one-on-one thing. But you know, I mean, it's for the most part, it's over the internet. So your image over there, that's all you can do is represent yourself through a website or something like that. So make it legitimate, make it count, and do a good job with it and take the time. And like you said, that's going to separate yourself. You guys do that. And, you know, I think it pays off in the end. So
yeah.
I do have to give credit to my wife for helping me with all that. She's one of the brains behind that kind of thing. But, you know, it's an evolving thing. So just
cool.
But it's important for what we do.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. So, all right, man, it's been good talking with you, and I guess we'll have to catch up and see what happens in the following year.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I'll be at Daytona next month for that expo,
okay.
And hopefully I'll see you guys at Tinley in October.
Awesome.
We will
be there. Thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate the time.
Yeah,
definitely.
No problem. Thank you.
All right, guys. Take care.
All right.
Thanks.
You too.
Okay. Some cool stuff, man. Some cool cool projects he's got going on.
Yeah.
I will have those rings before you, though.
Now I have to burn your house down. So it's the only way to stop you. I don't want to do it, but you're forcing my hand here.
Let's see which sells first. Is it going to be the albinos or the car?
No, we're not doing no. We ain't doing that. No.
I'm just kidding.
Go to hell. plus, I already told you what I got to do this year, so, you know. Yeah.
Yep.
What I got to get this year going.
Yep. That's cool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Don't worry. Like I said, we'll have the opposite projects, and we'll be able to hook each other up. We'll be fine.
Yeah.
So, all right. I don't really have anything else.
Well,
other than
I do love how it has, like, on the criteria for the show, it has at the end just Owen's speech. I mean, are we eventually getting down to that point now?
Ah, you like that, don't you?
This is where Owen says words. Okay. All right.
Well,
okay.
I don't know what you're going to say, but when you get down the road, grab
we never
you
know what I'm going to say. That's the whole point. I'm still here.
Yeah. You have a speech prepared, and you did good.
What? You didn't do any kind of preparation?
No.
No.
So
you answered
good.
That quickly. Anyway.
So, yeah, okay, let's run down this list and let's get the heck
yes,
out of here.
Please, God.
Let's see, our sponsors. First, we have Morelia Python's forum, moreliapythons.com. You know, we talked about it at the beginning of the show. I think if you're in the carpets in Morelia, you know, please be sure to post your pics and maybe let's get some kind of thread over there or discussion to get things livened up again and make that your first stop when you're going to go post something up. And I think that we can get that back to where it was. So that's my speech on that. ShipYourReptiles.com, ReptileReport.com, and the marketplace. Ship Your Reptiles if you want to ship. Reptile Report just kind of gives you the up-to-date information as far as what's going on in the reptile world. And marketplace, if you got some animals you want to sell, 'tis the season, be sure to go over there. And, you know, we talked about it in a previous episode, the benefits of the marketplace. It's definitely an up-and-coming spot and something that you should take advantage of. This Saturday, the 26th is the Northwest Carpet Fest. It's in Seattle, Washington, and they have their They have the auction going on right now.
Right now. Right now.
So they have some cool stuff over there. Go to the Northwest Carpet Fest page. I think it comes up NW Carpet Fest. And you can see what is up for sale there. I think, Owen, you have a
$200 voucher.
And I think I have.
You have a voucher up, too.
Yes. So if you're interested in anything that we have going on and you want to donate to a good cause, by all means, go over there, check it out.
Put it this way, the guy who won the one I put up for the Northeast, came by at one of the shows, he'd won it, and then he got himself a caramel carpet python for $50.
Yep.
So yeah.
Bad day for you, good day for
him. I had to do that. Yeah, I mean, you know, pissing me off, but.
Yeah. But like Howard said at the beginning of the show, it's a 50-50 split unless the donor suggests otherwise, and it's 50-50 between Rico Walder and U.S. ARC. So go over there. There's links on NPR.com. There's links on our Facebook page, et cetera, et cetera. Deadline is Thursday for U.S. ARC is putting out the there was no extension. They're taking comments regarding the listing of the five species of snakes, which is the boa constrictor, reticulated python, the Chauncey's anaconda, the green anaconda, and the Benny anaconda. As injurious under the Lucy Act, these species were originally posted in 2010. If listed, the Fish and Wildlife would ban the interstate transportation and importation. Remember, if you're going over there to comment, please be professional with your comments.
Yes, do not just start screaming curse words. That is not helpful. Do not threaten to release your cages full of retics. Also not helpful. So,
right. And remember, this may only be affecting those five at the moment, but any species could be next. So, I mean, let's, Chris brought up a good point. Let's see what's the next biggest snake after a retic.
Probably be in the scrub area.
Scrub? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And scrubs, then what comes after
olives,
that?
And if you really want to get scary, if they're really going to be pushing a boa, if boa goes, so goes the world. I mean, because almost any python that anybody is interested in can be close to the same size as a boa constrictor. So.
Yeah.
That is a major issue that they're even talking about boa, and everybody's kind of sitting by. I know I went over and filled out the form, and then I actually made my father do it at work today, a man who has no idea what I've told him to do or could care less about the snakes but knows it's important to me. So don't just get you. If you can, ask some family members to get going. Just write in and get this stuff taken care of. And U.S. ARC even has sample letters that you can post if you're nervous about what to say. So there is no more excuse. Go, do it. We'll wait here.
There's, the entire pet community is, we're being picked apart, and we're not supporting each other. And we said this before, and, you know, if everybody that had a leopard gecko and everybody that had a reticulated python were sending in their comments, we wouldn't even be talking right now probably. But that's not the case. So you have to support the whole reptile community, the whole thing, you know. It's important that we're together, united. We can disagree. You can think that retics should be – that people shouldn't have them, or maybe they should be permanented or whatever, but – I guess you have to understand who we're up against and how they think. They think that we should not have anything, and they can pick us apart because they know that a lot of times reptile people disagree a lot on certain things, and I don't know. It's just it's not the same with other things. Like if you're, you know, in the guns or stuff like that, similar type of things, you know, everybody that I think the Barkers talked about, people that would keep and breed falcons, you know, they kind of had the same type of thing, but everybody got together and the legislation was not even talked about. So it's important, man. So go over and do your part. I did my part, and Owen did his. We're expecting you all to do the same. And you only have until Thursday, so make it count. So tomorrow's the day. So take the time, take 10 minutes, whatever, you know, 15 minutes, whatever, and sit down, write your comment, be professional, and get it done. So that's that. Morelia Python Radio, moreliapythonradio.com. Added some of the new morphs to the morph page. There's a new blog that we're going to do over there, just updates and all that kind of stuff, so you can go check that out, what's in the world of Morelia and pythons and et cetera, et cetera. Check out our Facebook page and Twitter for more updates of what we got going on, shows coming up, guest news, etc. If you have any questions, please feel free to send us an email at info@moreliapythonradio.com, and check us out on iTunes.
iTunes. Oh yeah. My God.
Next week, next week's show, we're going to be talking Bloods and Short Tails with Nick Baltino from Cold Blooded Earth. Should be a cool show. We already got a bunch of questions in for Nick, which is cool. So if you have any questions about, you know, Bloods or Short Tails, be sure to send it in at info@moreliapythonradio.com. So I'm looking forward to talking to him. I did a lot of research for the show. Hopefully I do the Blood and Short Tail people justice and trying to figure out the questions they want to know. So Nick seems like a really cool guy, super passionate. I think he works at a zoo, I believe. He's a keeper, but works with Bloods and Short Tails, and he has a very, very nice collection of stuff going on. So it should be a great show. Then the week after that, I'm not sure, but the following week, we're going to be talking with Ben from Australian Addictions
about
genetics, specifically tiger genetics.
Genetics. So there we go. Yeah. We'll pause now for everyone to gasp and start typing on your keyboards. Go on. We'll wait.
And then the following week after that, this is a cool show idea that actually, Justin from Australian Addictions contacted me, and we're going to be talking about. He's going to be talking about his field herping trips to Australia, and he's going to be talking to us about some of his adventures over there. And it should be a cool show.
Sounds good.
Yeah, looking forward to that. So, some cool shows coming up. And as far as me, EB Morelia. Stay tuned for what I have available. We're just have babies getting their first shed, eating their first meals, and then soon after that, you'll see what I have available. Sign up for my newsletter, and that's going to be where I send what's available first out. So you got first picks if you're signed up on that. And you'll be able to get in on the action. I'm going to try to do some kind of, you know, some kind of discount. I haven't worked it out, that if you are a subscriber to that you'll get some kind of discount. So go over to ebmorelia.com. If you have any questions for me, comments, what's something that maybe you're interested in, feel free to reach out to me at eric@ebmorelia.com. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Owen's speech.
Shut up. So what I got is you can go to rogue-reptiles.com. We've done some updating. We're not done yet. You can also go to Rogue's Facebook page to see all the animals that we have currently for sale. That is actually up to date. Oh, my God, I know. So all the animals we currently have for sale at Rogue, shut up, are on the Facebook page. And we're going to start putting them up on King Snake as well as the Reptile Report Marketplace and a few other places up for sale.
If you see any babies or if you are curious about the clutches, let us know. We have just had a clutch of tiger carpet pythons, HCQ tiger, cross the red tiger, hatch out. If this is something that interests you, let us know. And, of course, the Brettles are due in August. We have one show scheduled, and that is the 2nd of August in Hamburg, Pennsylvania. So come check us out there. That's all I got. So what we'll say is good night. And thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you all next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.
Hey, Chad Brown here. You may remember me as a linebacker in the NFL or as a reptile breeder and the owner of Pro Exotics. I've been herping since I was a boy, and I've dedicated my life to advancing the industry and educating the community about the importance of reptiles. I also love to encourage the joy of breeding and keeping reptiles as a hobbyist, which is why my partner Robin Markland and I create the Reptile Report. The Reptile Report is our online news aggregation site bringing you the most up-to-date discussions from the reptile world. Visit thereptilereport.com every day to stay on top of the latest reptile news and information. We encourage you to visit the site and submit your exciting reptile news, photos, and links so we can feature outstanding breeders and hobbyists just like you. The Reptile Report offers powerful branding and marketing exposure for your business, and the best part is it's free. If you're a buyer or a breeder, you got to check out the Reptile Report Marketplace. The Marketplace is the reptile world's most complete buying and selling destination, full of features to help put you in touch with the perfect deal. Find exactly what you're looking for with our advanced search system. Search by sex, weight, morph, or other keywords, and use our Buy It Now option to buy that animal right now. Go to marketplace.thereptilereport.com and register your account for free. Be sure to link your Marketplace account to your Ship Your Reptiles account to earn free tokens with each shipping label you book. Use the Marketplace to sell your animals and supplies and maximize your exposure with a platinum ad that also gets fed to the Reptile Report and our powerful Marketplace Facebook page. Buying or selling? Use shipyourreptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rates. ShipYourReptiles.com can also supply you with the materials needed to safely ship your animals successfully. Use ShipYourReptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rates, the materials needed to ship your reptiles successfully, live customer support, and our live, on-time arrival insurance program. We got you covered. Visit thereptilereport.com to learn or share about the animals. Click on the link to the marketplace, find that perfect pet or breeder, then visit shipreptiles.com to ship that animal anywhere in the United States. We are your one-stop shop for everything reptile related.